A History of Holden Village. Conversations by Ellen Gamrath with Carol and Mary Hinderley, long time associated with the village. Listen now as Carol begins the conversation.
My starting point was way back at the seminary days when we discussed, and I wrote a very profound paper. I got scolded for doing a PhD for a bachelor's, which is what it is. But how do you produce community without creating a sense of an elite group? What the church uses a Latin phrase for it, but a church within the church. And it's always been a dead end when that happens. And that's one problem when you think about retreats or retreat movements or a third order. And Howard Hong and I, being friends from way back, had that dream together, and someday we thought we could start it together. So when the first time Holden Village came to me on paper, I'd been asked before, as soon as Mary and I got back from Norway and Denmark, on a Fulbright Class A that had been high living and research work and a lot of fun. And so I thought, oh, I should finally be a scholar, not a promoter. And I turned down any idea that the men then in the youth movement had, that I ought to head what they had accepted, in spite of my feeling they shouldn't accept it, this gift of Holden Village. I felt it was too far away. It was in the weakest area of our Lutheran church we had. Both Mark Leek and I agreed on that. Stewardship couldn't be worse in our Lutheran church than it was in that particular area. We'd had a youth convention in Seattle years ago to strengthen youth work in our churches there, which we felt was about as weak as anywhere. So it was a problem thinking of a retreat center where people had a hard time finding their way to church on Sunday morning, where they claimed that the white on the mountains was their letters of transfer from their churches in the Midwest, and where the new migrations that came from the countries that had fed our churches in the Midwest were not related to revival movements or to a biblical emphasis, but were simply what we call bread and butter migrations. And many of these, especially Scandinavians, were more favorable to a Pentecostal type of expression they were the Lutheran church. So I really wasn't very eager about Holden Village. When the written call came from the board, I responded to it because it came to us up at our cabin where we have really a retreat of our own. And Howard was there. I read it to him and we discussed it. And I said, would you be willing to be the manager? And he said, yes, he would. Okay, then. I said, I'll only accept it if they let you be the manager. And on that condition, sent it back and they turned it down because our youth directors had made out of it kind of a retirement for former youth directors. Well, that's one big argument I had right away. Pretty strong in one quarter, because I said it's not supposed to be a place where we can look forward to finally living it nice after we've been running all over the world and enjoy an in-depth experience where we've had so much superficiality with youth movements. It had to be something brand new, something entirely different. I knew that from the beginning. And it was very difficult for me, finally, to see that this was where I belonged. I finally wrote to Ricky in that winter and said I was willing to reconsider there, provided I would be the only one called besides Gilbert, who was serving without salary. I couldn't see spending my time raising a number of very fine salaries, according to that time. Back in 1962, when they were set, certainly salaries at $12,000 for everybody and $12,500 for the youth director were not out of line with the economy at all. It was very good. It's better than our average pastors were getting. And I just thought, where am I going to find that kind of money except from average pastors who are getting less? So I said, if I can take the whole thing, fine. And that's the way we settled it. And we came out then. Right away I began, and my journal through those months is rather complete because I was at the seminary and they were very good to me. They allowed me to have all my classes on Tuesday and Thursday, so the rest of the week I had for the village. And also I had agreed to help our evangelism department as its theologian in transit around the church, and that gave me an access to areas where I would not have gotten in easily coming for Holden Village. When we first came out, it was rather...
Well, Carol, it also gave you... They paid your expenses.
Well, they did that every year for the first
year. Because
Holden,
we didn't have any, really...
They even paid my salary. They gave the money to the village for my salary. So
we didn't... It was a way of Carol's getting a salary that would then meant that he could keep on earning more money for eventual improvements at the village and so on, and all didn't have to go into salary and gas.
Well, it was sort of a blackmail situation, an unusual tact and approach. I had told the Vance Department if they were helping a ministry to the rich at $12,000 a year, why couldn't we have as much for Holden Village? And they said, well, we can't free that. Well, okay then. I said, I can certainly give time to you and you can pay the village what they pay me, which
that
is the way we did.
That was through the ALC.
Yeah.
That was through the ALC.
They really subsidized it.
They subsidized Carol for not for the whole year, but for good periods of time when he could be used under their Department of Evangelism and doing resource preaching for the pastors.
Well, the other shock on that, Mary, too, was that we were paying the faculty rather large hunks of honorarium.
At the beginning.
And I said, this simply can't go on that basis. It's impossible. So I went to Paul Bohl, who was a dear friend from way back. We were brothers in the Lord and very close to each other. And I said, can you pull me out from underneath this? I'd like to have money enough for my salary during this period as well as for the people who are already on the faculty for the summer. One of them, M.B. Fritz Norsted, who was ALC. Another was Mr. Grams, who was Missouri Synod. So it was a mixture. And Paul Bohl agreed. And the chairman of his board, M.B. Cousin of Mary's right then, these cousins of ours haven't heard us in building Holden Village, so it went through all right. And that really saved me from guilt in that early time. Our first coming up, it was rainy, the boat leaked, kids were along. It was desperately depressing, and we got there and the doors were locked and they would not unlock them for us. So we had to stand out in the rain.
People that were there were here.
Finally, I went in through a kitchen
and they
door.
They said we couldn't come in there.
And they said, we're not going to unlock the doors while anybody's eating. And I said, well, I'm here and they're paying guests with us, you're letting them in.
See, we had some people with us.
That was my first fight to get in. It was a fight to even get in. That was my first experience of the village when it was in session. It was really bad. It was so bad you can't believe it. Then it was raining all the time. There's no place to go. I wrote my friend Dave Freuss. He was a pastor then. And I just said, Dave, you get things done. There's no place for people who are older here to go. We don't have any fireplaces.
One fireplace.
Well,
Gilberg had gotten into Shelley 5.
Oh, yeah. He was in
he wasn't living there.
But anyway, we didn't have places where they had rescue. So he sent me money right away for 2 Franklin Stove fireplaces. I got that practically the next mail, a week later. And I realized that there were people who would back us on this. My first conversation I came in was from a very brilliant family in the Augustana Synod, four brothers. Their father, as a pastor, had been given an honorary doctorate at Concordia when Mary's father was president of Concordia, so I knew they were very friendly towards me, and that was no problem. And I asked him, this particular doctor was there, all of them from Duluth, what should we do with this place? And he said, conversation. He says, I haven't had a conversation in 20 years. He said, conversation is happening here. Well, I said, we think that will buy me any money? Well, he says, it won't lose you any, you know. I said, I'm going to hitchhike back to North Dakota right now. I'm going to hitchhike around North Dakota. I'm going to towns where I've never been, which are not strong for the old ELC, which are largely former ALC, and see what can I do in terms of raising money for something brand new. And the only place where I had a bad time was where the ELC was strong, in Bismarck. There the pastors refused to even let me in. I waited for 40 minutes. They finally said, we believe in being frank. We don't want you. We think Holden Village is another burden for the church. We've got our own Bible camp.
They really felt threatened.
And I said, do you really think I'm going to build a Bible camp that far from everybody when we aren't using the ones we've got now? I said, the Bible camp movement has already failed. We tried to tame the Holy Spirit. It's over. This is something new. It's something for adults. Something that won't appeal to too many people, but something I think our church needs. We're lay people of this stature who really think, who've got questions, can come to a place where they don't expect maybe to find even answers, but find better questions. And it's going to be that kind of a place. Well, they did at least tell me one multimillionaire in town I could see who helped youth work, and I did try to see him, and I didn't get there. They wouldn't let me in, which hasn't happened too often, but it did happen. So I went over to the clinic, the medical clinic in Bismarck, believing doctors and dentists would be the group that would build this financially, which is what proved out to be true, and got support immediately, which has continued till this hour under the others. Eventually, these fellows, these pastors, who were there, said, we're never going to use this. Every Lutheran church and some non-Lutheran church in Bismarck has been out to Holden Village, whether it's young adults or it's adults. So that's the difference after some years, of course. But I crisscrossed North Dakota very much, because North Dakota is a state which is always believing there's going to be depression, so they've got some money to give. And during that period, really the highest per capita income in America was North Dakota. And they were generous. And that's how we got some of the cash to start with. And I sometimes teased about it, isn't quite true, but it's not way off either, that if there's a town with a granary and a bank, I've been there. But it was interesting to see the response.
Isn't that where Wes is from, too?
Wes is from South Dakota.
South Dakota.
That's a peculiar thing about this. Wes is from the town which my grandfather came to when he was bankrupt from Norway with his children and had his first farm. And so that part of the country, of course, that part of the country knew me, and it was easy to get in because I had been a pastor on a radio program which covered most of these parishes, because there were multiple parishes having services every other Sunday because the pastor couldn't get to all of them. And so they figured I was their pastor too. And it covered a lot of Minnesota. In fact, one of our good givers later had a hard time giving because she was still angry at me, because she said that when I left the radio ministry, her brother quit listening to the church services. So she was a little bit unhappy that I'd left Watertown. That was way over at Alexander, Minnesota. But we had a good support from that area of the church immediately, not least from, I would say, several groups, and we should credit them. That's the former Free Church group, former Danish group. They understood what a retreat would be. They understood the need of something like this, where laymen could meet other laymen who were really motivated, who had intellectual and spiritual intensity that wasn't shared too much maybe in an ordinary parish, and they could stimulate and hold one another for strong parish leadership. And this was true at certain centers and all the synods, like Valparaiso and the Missouri Synod was a strong support that way. And of course, St. Olaf, Augustana, Rock Island. I had turned down a call to Rock Island only a year before to teach there at Augustana, so I felt at home there and with the professors there. And we quickly had a strong support group within those three colleges. And that gradually spread to the others, but those three picked it up right away.
They were places where dialogue was occurring.
Exactly. They were open to this kind of an experience. And like beautifully was said by Conrad Bergendorf after his first summer at the village, he said, "You are succeeding where our colleges failed." He said, "We always had to drag along this European tradition," he said. And he said, "Well, this cluttered up our communication." And he used the word, "You are creating a conversation that's commensurate with a culture in which the witness to Jesus has to happen." Very interesting that he put it this way, because at our 10th anniversary, I said with Dr. Schutz present, who'd come there rather than to the welcoming banquet for his successor, Kent Knudsen, because he felt that strongly about the village. He had urged me to take it thinking it would fail, but he said I had enough ego to take another failure, is the way he put it. And I said to him, "Well, his problem and mine was that we were thinking in terms of how many miles it was from anywhere, whereas this youth generation was thinking in terms of how many hours was it away, and that would help in its success if it were to succeed." But it was obvious that if it takes you a day to get there, after you've gotten there, you've got some problems in communication as far as travel. But anyway, Schutz yelled from his table when I said that Holden Village had its part in shaping the San Antonio experience for the ALC. I sat in
that was when the, that was when San Antonio decided that women
should be ordained.
They should have equal voting, everything, equal votes.
Yes, that was there. There were 10 propositions at San Antonio for the ALC, actually.
That was
were
in,
very important.
Dear, what year 10, was that?
It was about, 68 or so. I brought apples down there from Holden Village.
We thought it
for everybody.
Had been in existence.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
About 68. About 4 or 5
it was about 68 then.
Darryl
more
and
than
Carol.
That. About 7 years.
And Fern and Joanne and I all went down, and I think Fern and Darryl, I'm not sure if it was Fern and
Fern Olson.
We bought these beautiful, delicious apples that you can buy in Chelan that are seconds. That is, they're not really seconds, but they're so much cheaper. We got them for $2 a box.
Yes.
And we
had
brought,
one for every
dollar. Brought them down, and Carol and Darryl went around and put an apple on it with a Holden Village brochure on every delegate's place at the San Antonio convention, which was the which is the biennial convention of the American Lutheran Church.
Well, they had resisted us prior to that
time
doing anything.
Some of the people were really mad, but they eat their apples.
Well,
but eating an apple, you can't be real pumped.
But you see, the church is trying to protect its Bible camp program. This looked like that wrecked it. It was already. It wasn't wrecked.
Well,
it
wasn't
lost
doing
its course.
What?
In the 30s, it was the greatest thing we had going in the Augustana Synod in the Free Church in the Norwegian Lutheran groups. And from my experience in the armed forces, the number of Sunday school teachers and so on that come through that is they either come through the parochial schools of Missouri Synod, or they come out of the Bible camps of these others. So those are the two biggest forces for teachers in the armed forces, other than Baptists. But the reason why you go to these Sunday school teachers conventions and over half of them are Lutheran is right there at that point. But the village had a lot of help immediately, because I had been, for instance, 7 times to Berchtesgaden with great lay people who were now retiring from the army, and some of those came up to us and built our dock after it was destroyed, and our bridge, a few things like that. And we knew a lot of lay people in the various synods, and that's one reason why the youth men wanted me to begin with. But it was a very close pull the first years. I had to lie every meeting. The only thing I had to complain, because the youth, they weren't supporting us very much, but they would have probably, little they were, if they knew I only had 50 registered for the summer in May. But that's the way it was in May. And we'd finally get through, and we'd have a pretty good July and August, as one member of the board put it, and that's the kind of board members I got from the youth department, because they just gave me people they didn't want in their boards, and then they satisfied their ego by handing them keys. Well, some of them were, and this gal said, well, there's nothing to making this a success. We only have to get as many people in the other months as the years we're getting in July and August, and we've got it made. I said, yes, that's like telling North Dakota farmer all he has to do is have 4 harvests a year and he's going to be okay. But I mean, that's what I was dealing with on intelligence. And then the sister of that girl came up and said, does my sister hate you? I had to come up here and see it. She became one of our very strong faculty members. I won't mention who it was. But anyway, that's what I dealt with. Another one, when he went off the board, he says, I got to respect you the way you live with your opposition. I said, well, that's the name of the game, isn't it? Because it was continual friction within the board and over against the church on trying to allow it to happen. And that's just the facts of the life, that's all. I made a lot of enemies that stayed in.
Well, one thing that at the beginning, in the early years, we did have to allow for people wanted to come up there and have conferences. You know, they wanted to have a conference of leaders of different areas. In
one very prestigious ones that Boeing wanted to bring up of international scientists.
Yeah. And at first, we just felt that we had to give room for this, although this was not what we wanted to do.
But we did talk it over, and the board talked it over, and we decided not to marry.
I know, but we did, not that one, but to begin with, we had that event.
We allowed them only for 1 week.
Yeah,
but we didn't allow any 4-week things.
No, I remember in the beginning you had a group that they brought their own program. I
yes.
was seeing very far out, but
yes.
it's not that.
No,
it's
right.
like that.
Yeah,
they
that's
went,
right.
CFO.
Okay.
Well, they came.
Camp farthest out.
This was the only way we could pay we had to pay our grocery bills. We had no credit, absolutely no credit. You couldn't get credit in Chelan or any place else.
We couldn't even get credit for American Express or a Visa card or something like that.
But also, we couldn't.
No credit card. We tried.
Visas, but we couldn't buy our flour or sugar or anything on time. We had to have the money and pay for it, because they absolutely were Chelan was convinced of this
place
was going down
fail.
The drain.
Everybody thought we'd fail.
And so we did have to find some means of support. And so before the actual village program started, the camp farthest out came up for 2, 3, or 4 years, and they were different. But they were supportive, and
they limbered
a lot
up
of the kids
too.
Couldn't get over it. They had devotions in motion, and of course this was before, it was quite a long time before the Lutherans had gotten into choreographed liturgy or anything like it, and these people were already swaying with grease, you know, figuring that was the Holy Spirit.
And some parts of it were rather innocent. It didn't mind. I never mind so much that some of them were talking to flies, but it bothered me a little bit. Some thought the flies were talking back to them. that kind of. But I still fought for them to stay, even when the board was against their staying. We had one incident up there and involved even a dear friend of mine that I prayed for years. I had about 10 fellows I prayed for consistently for their conversion. And of all crazy things, this man, a doctor, in one of our prestigious areas and well known, was on the school board and made a big fuss after Sputnik, and they got mad at him and had a recall to get him off because he thought they should do something else in school system besides sing songs and have dramas and play ball, and maybe they ought to learn a little bit of arithmetic even. And so they got rid of him, and it was such a shock to him that through it he got converted. But as I said, he didn't have to go and become extreme and join the Methodists afterwards, which he'd done. And he'd come up with them to one of the camps. And they had a great thing on healing. And one of the women broke her leg, and he claimed that they healed her and cleared. Fortunately, another doctor was up there, Presbyterian from Seattle at the same time, and got her down to Seattle. Well, that sort of had the board. They said, it's over. I said, give them one more year, and then, okay. I didn't want to have them out on that incident. So one more year, and that was it.
Interesting thing.
They came in the very, well, nobody wanted it. See, they came up the first or second week in June when we had no one.
Yeah, and gave us a full week and paid in cash. We never had any late payments on it. Ruth Carter Stapleton, the, you know,
she came
Carter
there,
sister,
we had some grand
there.
People.
With that group?
Oh,
with
yes.
That group.
That group.
I remember she was the one that said, well, she would. What was that about the family altar?
Oh, she was beautiful. I mean, we loved her because she said she used to try to impose a family altar on her family. She said, come hell or high water, we're going to have a family altar. And she suddenly said, am I crazy to bring him in under the gospel by putting him under the law? So she said, from that time on, she said, I yelled a promise at them as they went to school in the morning. Well, she won us Lutherans on that one. I mean, I told her anytime I can send her some money for her program after that. But we had some fine people involved with them. Really, and it wasn't all bad by any means, and we were very grateful to make use of those awful rainy first weeks when we were just getting started, and allow us to train in our volunteer staffs, because we were working now with all volunteers. We had a bad experience in volunteers for 2 or 3 years, unfortunately, in which Elmer Witt would go along and amen me, I know, because he certainly tried to raise the staff, and August was his time. And we didn't have anybody, and I had to come down here. I saw the man who was later bishop for this area of the Missouri church, because he had a church next to my cousin's in West Seattle, and we were friends. I said, I gotta help. And Jake said, I'll get the help for you. And he did. He had the, you know, the local man could do it. It's an example of how I used to say that rather than 3 different synods owning this place, I wish I had about 30 congregations and somebody would own it. But we had that. Then we got rid of that, because up to that, Elmer had to operate the Missouri youth couldn't be there when any other youth, you see. He had operated under that kind of a discipline. It wasn't his fault. And from that time on, we just forgot all about them. We had great Missouri workers, you know. In fact, one gal without whom we would never finally arrange the ease with which we're collecting money today. We finally got our list in order and spent 6 months up there every winter doing it.
How old was she? Dorothy Carroll?
Yes.
Oh,
Dorothy
she
Carroll.
Finally in her 80s. Well, yeah. The reason she retired is she began to feel that she was...
Yes, I know. She wouldn't have retired. Dorothy would never retire because she didn't want to work, but
she
was concerned about her.
Well, I think of that Swedish, I always call it Swedish Covenant. They got another name now. That great layman from him, he came up there laying down our sidewalks piece by piece, but he also made up our prayer calendars. It was just a dream support. And once when Lutheran Brotherhood said that they weren't supporting me because I wasn't a Lutheran, and I said to Lutheran Brotherhood, when they decide I'm not a Lutheran, that'll be day for me when a bunch of grown-up Boy Scouts decide I'm not a Lutheran. Well, we went over and just talked with one of the grand givers of the covenant, who was handing money out right and left. And I said, I determined when I took this, I'm not taking money from non-Lutherans. I said, this is something Lutherans should do for the whole people of God. But I'm so grateful a lot of your people are bringing people up here. So I just want to talk to some guy that's reasonable for a little while after my last little conversation. Well, Daryl was with me in both cases and can bear witness to my accuracy, but it was fun just to talk to a grand person. And the same way, for instance, somebody like Rockefeller, David, he was beautiful, easy to talk to. Al Pitchard preached that day in his church, and I had gone to hear him because Al's a dear friend. In fact, one of the people I intend to get on the faculty right away for his gift and kind of getting people with it where it's at and not antagonizing him while he does it. He's a real gracious way of communicating. And when you're going to get a hold of people that have been racist and don't know it, you've got to have somebody like Al to do it, because before they flare up, they're kind of convinced that this is wrong, and then they can move. Well, anyway, I had been there, and he was very genial with me. And I told him, I said, I hope when Holden Village has it made, the Rockefeller Foundation would do something about bringing the blacks out of the ghettos of our nation. To a Holden, I said, it's too bad that only the armed forces lets our blacks know that they own America and gets them around it. So there's one thing a retreat center like this can do. Its tremendous advantage from the beginning was its dramatic location. It was against it from succeeding very quickly, but its complete isolation, coming up a pure water lake that you can drink. I used to say that the two things Europe had, I thought, that we didn't have worth seeing were the Norwegian fjords and the Tyrolean Alps. Well, our Alps are like the Tyrol, and we had this beautiful big horseshoe circle that we actually owned a lot of it. So you could look up there and say, you own those mountains. It helped,
I think. The lake, really, Chelan is about as close to a fjord as I can think of, inland fjord, because it starts out and gets deeper and deeper into the mountains and more rugged. You know, the heights are tremendous.
And that gives you a feeling of moving away from things, and also what I have found is that there is confrontation with no escape.
Yes.
And that we have so many
ways
to get out in other places.
Exactly. I remember George Utek was a poet in residence one of the first years, and he had this wonderful image of the village as being, because of the coming up by water, that it's like going through baptism, and that it is a death as you leave, because you do have to leave everything that's of yourself, your supports, your status, if you've got any, and also your bad past. If you've got a really bad past, that too you leave. And everything is gone.
Like a new beginning.
It's a rebirth. And he
it's
said,
going over.
This is the wonderful...
Let me know if it goes out.
This is the wonderful thing about... Because we used to think, oh, if we only were a little closer. But he said, no. He said, you know, to come to hold, you almost need that long a time to have a subconscious preparation. And that's what he considered it. And I've thought about it since.
And then all those tunnels that we owned, those we did own, something like 70 miles at one time, but 55 miles of railroad in it. And it left right away that great illustration you could use immediately. There's room in there for all of you to dig a grave and leave your past on it and put it as finished and walk out of here without any guilt and know you're forgiven. And the only thing you're allowed to be guilty for is guilt if you're a Lutheran or if you're a Christian. I just finally got that through to a lot of our people. Really thought the job of a Christian was to produce guilt instead of lift it. You know, we had a lot of that nasty sort of thing going with negative legalism. In fact, Elmer Witt used to tease me that my job was so much easier than his, because the legalism amongst the Scandinavians was good for a laugh. I said, yeah, if only somebody were laughing about it. But his, nobody knew it was there. He says, we got a catechism as a gimmick, and the living Christ can't break through. They got the answers. You know, which is true, you see. So we had this continual concentration between the sins. It was beautiful. I should say one thing for the record right here, because it was beautiful. Bill Bugie was fuming after a lecture by Conor Berkendorf on this whole matter of his inner lecture. And I was giving a back rub in the sauna, which is what I oftentimes did with these guys. They kept sitting there talking. And a good time. He was telling how Missouri Synod had always been critical of me and my ministry because there was so much joy in it. But now finally maybe he had more than his. You could see it sprang from the gospel and not from any kind of, you know, rah-rahness or anything. And then as we were talking, I said, well, why don't you get back with Berkendorf and help me? He said, you know, I've really fought for this common front of Lutheranism. And he says, we've got each one deal with the group we've got, and I got to deal with mine. Well, Conor Berkendorf was the Lenten missioner for Valparaiso that year, where Bill Bugie was in charge. And this happened over and over again. So when I did say at this 10th anniversary that Holden Village had its share in shaping a whole new image of the Lutheran Church in America, that's where Schatz was right. And he said,
that was 73.
He shouted out right from his table.
72, I guess.
You know, he didn't worry about who was there. Well, then another bishop there, angry because I wouldn't let him talk. Well, I was afraid he'd lay it on too heavy, because he'd gone to his dentist one morning, and his dentist had loaded him with Holden Village the whole time he was sitting at the dentist. And, of course, he'd been a sort of for me from way back when. I mean, childhood on, practically. But Mal Knutson was really furious that I wouldn't let him speak. So then he wrote an article for The Standard, which didn't help us so much because he gave me sainthood before I was dead. But they wanted a picture of me, so I sent one in a t-shirt so that they'd know what Holden Village was like, where we were very dressed up. But the church gradually started to respond when they saw that there was a group. But you see, the tightness was over against this feeling that you're going to develop an in-group again, an elite group. A little bit of that started happening in Seattle areas, coming back to me from some of the pastors. So I put up signs that we aren't necessary, you are. We're necessarily only while we create a stronger parish for you to enjoy where you are. Because that every person I examined whenever I taught at the seminary, and they let me examine seniors before they went in, I said that if you haven't seen that the parish is the only place where the kingdom becomes history, because it's through the word and sacrament that Christ gets into our life and then through us into our civilization, you have no right to a parish, because that's the hem of Christ's rule. And that's where the excitement is. Well, I took on Al Deering to be the fundraiser finally. Paul Bowe was so happy he cried, because suddenly I could do something with my scholarship besides raise money. Al had a heart attack, of course, in 2 weeks, and that was the end of that. But as we sat there with the two big shots in our church, George Shultz, the powerhouse mentally in our investments and so on, and the man who was in charge of stewardship, whom I will not mention him. But anyway, he was furious with me. I was destroying the glamour of the parishes and so on. And I said, I've got 28 cousins in the ministry. I should make life more miserable for them. Well, suddenly he was ambitious to be president of the church, and his face has changed. Al laughed. I've never seen somebody change from hate to concern so quickly. Well, there should be some way that the church could relate to this. Then George Shultz said, yes, but it doesn't appeal to more than 10% of the people. And George, I said, 10%? 2%. But that's the percentage that belongs to the church tomorrow and that leads us so we aren't at a dead end. That keeps us from using piety to escape from the real issues of the theological confrontation with our times and our culture. It keeps us from just being an acculturated church. Because my plight, when Dr. Schutz asked me to take this, I said, isn't it a shame that God gives a gift like this to his least imaginative family? And the
Lutherans.
The Lutherans. And I said, why didn't you give it to somebody else? Quakers, Methodists, Episcopalians, any one of them would be responding to this at once. It's going to take me years to see this thing go. Well, he said, I don't think it's going to go. You can take a favor. Well, I said, there's no reason why it shouldn't go, because we're so content with things as they are. After all, we live in the best land, and we know we're right, and the other fellows are wrong.
And we're all going to heaven.
And we've
been confirmed.
And we're just more fortunate because we Lutherans have got it right. Well, you know, when I had one of the statements I threw into this all the time at the village was, being uptight about being right is always wrong. Because you just... Well, I wasn't going to say that on the tape, but it was fun. And I did, at least I called him personally. Usually these letters I did. We had one, I always have had one principle everywhere where I've been. My secretaries read my mail first. And if it's not signed, throw it away. I did say to one area here in Bellingham, I put an ad in the paper I paid for myself, Bellingham did, the personals, that we believe in answering mail, we'd be glad to answer yours if only you would sign your name. Well, I knew who it was. It was a free church missionary that had been with us in the Philippines who never came to our Lutheran church all the time that we were in a prison camp after we'd been kicked out of the community worship for the sake of the gospel.
What do you think kept Holden from becoming elitist? Because people often, it's in their own minds, if not your intent.
Well, you know how they came back. I think one thing right away, I noticed that the first September, there were only two of us there for our Kierkegaard retreat with Al.
Two of you?
Two who came in as paid people for the week. Leo Busted and the gal from Yakima.
Esther Ellensburg.
Esther Ellensburg. That was
Esther Ellensburg. She was wonderful. She had come to the village on the volunteer staff in 62. I think she was with the Forerunners. And she came back, and well, actually that lay seminar we started in the fall was when we had not very many volunteers, because we couldn't afford to keep them we couldn't afford to feed very many of them in September. And so so the idea was to have a lay seminar, and the lay people wouldn't have to pay as much because everybody would help.
We'd all be working.
Cooking and whatever else we could do. And then we would have discussions. And of course, the very first year, that was the year that Carol was installed, we jumped right in and took Kierkegaard's Works of Love, which had just come out.
Well, it was a lot of fun.
It was Howard Nevins' translation, and the first people, I remember seeing this man on the boat with us, and
That was Leo.
And, well, be quiet, I
should help her a little bit.
I knew who he was.
Okay.
But I didn't know him. He looked like a bird, and I thought, and then he had green, he had GI green, sort of, you know, what do you call those things that they wear?
I don't know.
Fatigues?
Yeah, fatigues on. And he had a fishing rod, and I thought, oh dear, I suppose he's going to hold, and this looks like about what we're going to have. Somebody that isn't going to be interested in anything but going out and fishing and won't be interested in anything else. And I thought, well, we got up there, and sure enough, he got off the boat and was going up to Holton, and he was kind of preoccupied with what he was doing. And then we met him, and you know, we all fell in love with him, and his name from that time on was Brother Cinnamon, because when we worked in the kitchen, he helped me in the kitchen a lot, and he loved to put cinnamon on things. So I finally said, you know, I think we have to call you Brother Cinnamon, because you do look like a monk, and I think that's your taste. And so we all called him Brother Cinnamon from that time on. We had no idea who he was or what he was doing, because he was so interested in what he called Kierkegaard. Well, he said, I'm interested in Kierkegaard because our intern introduced me to him, and he said, I realized this man has got something to say to me, and I want to read about it. So Al Rodness and Nora Rodness, Carol and I...
And I'd come right out of the hospital. I had my first hernia from the pots and pans.
And Carol had just...
Never, you know, they refused even to honor your husband's bills for me because I'm a pastor and therefore I should not get that workman's compensation.
He shouldn't be working.
I should have sued them. Jim sued him in Texas and got it.
Jim Otter.
But I shouldn't, a pastor shouldn't be doing those
shouldn't
things.
Shouldn't be doing
those. Well, if I didn't do pots and pans, which is the lousiest job up there, why should the volunteers be celebrating their job? So that's where I kept mine. Then I did make a ruling that neither I nor the manager could ever drive a bus, which you changed later, or you didn't worry about the ruling.
I just never knew that was because
There was a tendency, if one of us drove a bus, that we'd be talking on the way up and showing them these things, and drove the pastors absolutely out of their mind. In fact, Anne, Troyce David's wife, will never come back. She's got so scared going up that...
Somebody was talking about
that.
Scenic trip.
And then,
there are a couple other people.
But anyway, but the September was a lot of fun because everybody was there, and I think in the kitchen and everybody's house, the conversation was always... And they got to be increasing that way through the years. Of course, September finally came very good because we had retired people. You were saying, how did we get these parishes on our side? Well, right away, the pastors knew I was a pastor and that I was under a certain protest and not being in a parish in a year. And they knew that. And there had been given immediately, well, this is so important, leave your job to help Holton Village. Well, Gil was enthusiastic. And I said, Gil, don't put a chip on the pastors. There's enough anti-clericalism around without our joining it. And from that time on, we became a great place for people to vent their feelings. They'd come up and say something about their pastor. I'd say, boy, aren't you glad there won't be a pastor in heaven? Oh, I wouldn't say that. They'd say, no, I said, there's not going to be a pastor. They won't need him then, you know. Well, this disarmed them, and they realized it takes some guts to preach the gospel, and that every pastor needed a bodyguard. And there was a constant emphasis up there. We're here to provide a bodyguard for the gospel. And so when these older people who retired from September went back to their pastor, we want to do youth work, it knocked them off their seat. Well, then they started thinking, well, who can do better work than an older person? They've lived with Christ long enough to put something to show on his face. Nothing appeals more to a teenager than an older person who really lived life out and isn't bitter but thankful and got some zip to him. What this church needs, as Howard used to say way back in college days, is more young old people and more old young people. Well, the village was there providing both. And that was part of it, no question about it. And the other part that we really did continually emphasize this always. And... It communicates. I mean, they were that you're there. Finally, I think the church bought it because they realized the fact that it did supply a real support group to a live parish, and that's kept on.
I think the thing that kept it from becoming elitist is that there was a great deal of celebration of all kinds of work. I mean, everything that was done was celebrated. And Carol's favorite statement always about the village was, if you work for it, that is, if you do something like, you know, digging, we've had to make a whole channel when we put in the hydro plant. And remember that channel that Paul Haynes had spent all his time standing upside down taking? That was when Michelle was just little and they tug out all those stones to make a channel into the pools. And Carol used to say, if you don't work in a place, you don't own it. But when you work for it, then you do own it.
Like Paul Hain and Al Pitcher, your friends, you know, they'd be in the kitchen immediately they got there. And I remember one of our faculty wives saying, we got more PhDs in this kitchen than some colleges have got in their faculty. Well, and a cousin of mine was a doctor, and he was tired, and there he was working on that, making, when we put in the electrical, that whole ditch to put in that pipe. I tell you, trying to collect money for a pipe is no way to collect it.
No, nobody sees any imagination.
First big
pipes.
Thing we had to, and then so many dollars for a 900 feet of pipe, each 900 feet, whatever it was. It was awful. 90 feet of pipe.
To interject excitement into that takes a lot of energy.
Well, anyway, this doctor was pounding. He was working. Jim is his name. He gave his boat to the village for the volunteer cruise that summer, by the way, asking me if I had, when I'd urged him to come out, he had a clinic that he owned in Austin, Minnesota. And he said, did you think if I took my boat out that I'd be game to do it? I said, no, why should you? I have a cabin in Northwoods. You don't. This is your entertainment. Okay, I believe you. He said, I'll leave the boat for you. His brother, Milton, I see his parish right away, of course, put us from Bellingham over here or Bremerton for $500 a year. And we had these cousins of ours supporting. One of Mary's cousins, his parish went and hit us for $2,000 a year. And the cousins got pretty good for us. I mean, the family helps their family when they're in trouble, and we were in trouble. But anyway, the finances gradually picked up. It was not necessary that I have to give all of summer winters to that. And working with the evangelism department allowed me to lecture on theology to pastors everywhere, including right in the area where the village was, all these pastors coming together. And invariably, some of them would poke through. I remember Pastor in California was, gave me $100 right away, another one, in fact. So I collect enough money out of just the pastors being together to see things move. And I didn't have the same feeling of running scared. But for about 7 years, it was. For about 7 years.
There's a fun little thing from his journal here that is so, it's so cute. No time to write. I am an automaton running scared. A few good gifts out of a good deal of preparation now put us out of the fear zone for the summer. Peebo came through with $4,000 yesterday, $150 from a Texas family. Paul Fanning gave me $1,000, and a new friend in Devil's Lake, as a result of my 8 talks there, gave me $500 and possibility of another $500. Program is in for 63. I can begin work on 64 and making tomorrow, so that knowing that tomorrow Holden Village will be taking. I'm using 40 hours a week on Holden, 25 hours a week in the seminary, 15 hours a week at the parish, and then in between that I try to sleep, but I don't have any fun.
Well, it was. I mean, then, see, I had this extra job while I was at the seminary because the seminary faculty, I was not on the faculty, I was there as a guest, and so I needed that income.
And then
all of a sudden, then the village started paying me the May 15th. So there's 2 weeks when I had a salary 3 days, and I took Eleanor out, I said, might as well come out one time with a millionaire when I have 3 incomes for 2 weeks. And that kind of put things
up. It was amazing because we'd had so little and been barely able to make it. Yeah. And then I was teaching in Augsburg
for $400.
Because I taught the nurses. I did. And that was because Carol asked Bernard Christensen to hire me. He said, Mary goes out and gives talks for nothing, and he said, she might as well make a little money. But you were only on salary then, from
May 15th. So
well, then from that time on, he was on salary all the time, which he didn't start until May. So up until that time, he was working for Holden, but he wasn't on salary.
The seminary knew this, and they were very good about it. Like I say, they allowed the spring quarter that I only had 2 days a week that I was at the seminary, Tuesday and Thursday. A little tough on the fellows. They wanted more time for me to see me, and I said, well, come on up to the village.
But you had a large family.
Yeah, we had 6 children. Care. And it was a lot, and we didn't have, we had one car, and we never had new cars, so they were always, one was always sort of semi-broken.
Well, like Johann said, when I get in the ministry, I'm going to buy a car that gets back to town when we go. But when I took the whole gang to Europe that time, and pastors were envious, I said, well, how much do you spend on cars in your ministry? Well, it looked funny. I said, well, I spent $2,600 a month. $2,600, that's how much I spent on one car. Well, I said, that's why we're going to Europe. Well, that was the only place where you could kind of, both with the IRS as well as the parish, get a little bit ahead of it. But I wasn't buying lousy cars. They look good.
But they
just didn't get you home.
No.
But one thing, I remember another very strong thing that he says here, and this was way back, in the first year. My first friendly group to Holden, where commitment is in the past, has
cheered my soul, the Lutheran Council of Greater Seattle. Now I go to the Inland, Inland Empire, pastors of the American Lutheran Church, our strategic support group. If I can swing them to a congregational canvas, we are on our way. My despair is lifting. At times, I felt the joke was stale. At least I could not laugh at it. Now I can again get distance to myself and approach more in God's humor in using me.
Well, that's been my life of discipline and my humor, I call it. Well, Aubrey Edmond introduced me, you know, and says, well, as we all know, we got Hinderly, the fanatic of the ELC, now he's out with us of the Village, and we're going to have to get behind him. You know? And that's just how he introduced me. But I got nowhere, of course, in the next mission, and it was, they could do anything. In fact, that particular synodical president from this area apologized for writing me a scolding letter lady, because I suggested that maybe they could reintroduce their Ascension Days by having a breakfast and communion. I always did in my churches. I said, and they have an offering. I said, only it would be very small, and you can send $2 from that offering to Holden Village. That's all I asked for, and he was furious. No right to ask congregation for any money. That was the LCD. Well, if you can't get it there, where can you get it? So I couldn't, and it took some years before the board had an official motion that I was allowed to collect money for Holden Village. That did not happen for the first 7 or 8 years. So I was all alone, and this was the whole grief of it. And nobody cared. When we reset the board and did it up differently, then things changed. Leo was behind that reorganization. It's stupid to have people on the board unless they personally are contributing to the place and at least know what is there. They'd come in to be a Supreme Court and move out again. That's all. There's no sense of support. There's no sense of friendliness.
And any judgment there isn't valid. If a person isn't suffering and praying for a place, they don't have any right to.
It was just crazy. Yeah, really. One of them got so angry at me, and he was a man, an officer of one of our food companies that Elmer had put on the board, and he really, his feelings were hurt, because Werner and I were saying that why don't we just go out and get drunk after this meeting? There's nothing else to do to something like this but to dismiss it that way. Well, we never had either one of us, but it was really bad. It was so bad. And in fact, Elmer was so sympathetic after the first board meeting we had in Minneapolis, because Mary and I went over then to one of our parishes, which was wanting to call us. Grace Lutheran in Eau Claire, and I have about 5,000-6,000 members, and it would be a busy ministry. And she did call a second, third cousin of mine there, but we had had this beautiful prayer for unity from a man on the board who was a Missouri Synod pastor, and then right afterwards a motion that would not be allowed to have communion there and so on. And Elmer looked at me and says, would you ever understand us? I said, no, Elmer, it's hard for me. I'm going over to Eau Claire on Sunday, and I think I'm through. I said, I don't think I can take this. Well, I went over there, and then what I did, I came back and I wrote the board letter. I said, I refuse, as last summer, the very first summer, to have communion under a chalet or back in a messed up room where they used to play cards and just junk in there now, so that nobody could be offended and we could have communion together who sought it. And furthermore, one of the Lutheran pastors furious at me because he had been permitted to know, and he had some youth up that he would have wanted there, and I couldn't even let it be known. This is simply sort of a secret communion within the community for the workers. I had to lay in a hand service that started right away because people said, how do you sustain the motivation up there? Well, I said, really, the issue hasn't come up. And it had. We never had trouble with motivation. I said, this place is built for crisis. And you say, it's got a casual excellence that responds every time there's a need. And it did. Kids would go out and sleep on the lawn and give up their beds to people coming in.
We were too full and didn't have supplies.
And it was terrific to see it there. And I had nothing in it. Anything but good, but they deserve to have communion. And I just wrote the boy, the letter I wrote the boy, I says, too far to swim to Chelan. We have no other access, and we have to have communion here, and I'm going to have it. Well, the member of the board, not this pastor, he never, ever relented on it. He kept the faith, you might say, with their point. But another layman said, we'll agree to look the other way. Well, when I told this to Skisgård in Denmark, he got up, walked around his table. Oh, he says, oh my God, I don't know if I could be a Lutheran in America. He says, how can you have a retreat that doesn't start in communion, you see? Well, this is the European understanding. You start as one body, you start in communion. Then you have all the differences you want mentally when you are seeking one glory and one Lord. You can confront some of these things and let them come into the open. And that's just what happened at the Village, of course.
Well, 2 years ago, the board made a specific request that we always start on Sunday so that they can have communion together. And then no matter where it goes, you are
We always started that,
exactly.
We did.
Exactly.
But now they made it a board request.
Because they requested, it wasn't like formal motion, but they said, can you, when you schedule it so that we come in on the Sunday.
Well, for the board meeting?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So they said they always felt like it was not complete. Oh, so something that you did or that you
got. We always had communion as a beginning because Carol felt that.
Well, we didn't. See, we had it secretly. Well, the first public communion, Paul Hayton and I had it together. And he's an ordained Missouri clergyman. And he doesn't remember, nor do I, which one preached and which one celebrated. I have a hunch he may have preached and I celebrated. But we don't remember. I don't. That was the first time. We had it on the 4th of July. Freedom from the Gestapo.
And it wasn't just, remember, this wasn't just Missouri.
No, LCA wouldn't allow us because they weren't in a church.
And then there were a lot of ALC synods who didn't believe in having communion at what, quote, Bible camps.
Yeah.
And they thought this was taking it out of the church.
Yeah. And so, we still didn't have a congregation.
And so also, they thought it was, people kept referring to it as a camp, and instead of a retreat center. And we used to come to blows with people because we tried to get it clear to them. It was not a camping place. This is a retreat center where you come for a specific reason, and it takes time, it takes a little money, but you do it because it has a priority. Well, you know, it's hard to make people, I spend so much time on the telephone in Minneapolis, because to explain it to the people in the Midwest who had never been out here, a lot of people from the West say, oh, well, it must have been nothing to sell it to the Midwest. After all, they love to come to the mountains. I said, yes, but they didn't want to come by way of a ferry boat that they had never heard of Lake Chelan, and they couldn't find it on the map, and they didn't know. And then after you got on that, then you had to take another boat, and what did you do with your car? What kind of clothes do you take along with you? It was all, I mean, it didn't seem to make any difference how many brochures we sent out. They had to hear, a lot of the people had to hear it by word of mouth.
Well, for Lake Chelan itself in the state of Washington, I think, for instance, the Tri-Cities prayer breakfast asked me to address them in the morning. This is one of the things that I started to use, and so I've been non-Lutherans more and more coming through that vehicle. And at that breakfast, I was speaking about Holden Village, and they did not know where Lake Chelan was, and there, same way Walla Walla. They did not know where Lake Chelan was. A lot of the people there. It was their own state. Well, if you can't in your own state have this problem,
but you see, but I can see why, because that was a wilderness area that people went to who liked to go hiking. Well, if you didn't like to go hiking, you know, if you were into boating or golfing or RVs, I mean, there wasn't that, because it wasn't that good for, unless you stayed in a motel at the end of the lake where it was warm, then you could, you know, in Chelan.
And you still had, I think, one dear guy whom I respect deeply. He sent up a letter describing each person coming from his parish that year and what he expected to happen for them at the village and what he did not expect to happen to them at the village. But I could amen that. I knew his concern. He was getting the leadership group in his parish, and they were the leadership group, no question about it. And able guys. One was a doctor, and the other one was selling mobile homes of a certain kind after he had a big business. And differed with his partner, access to Jesus Christ. Decided a non-Christian and a Christian couldn't unite in a business very easily. And said, you name the price for which you'll buy it up, and I'll buy it from you. Well, he wanted to buy it, okay. He was out there. We had a good group from that. It was a powerful area for us, actually. But it's an area where I've had preaching missions in both of the main churches, one former Danish, one ours, as well as in the area around. And then you finally got them coming. It was interesting. And the strength went back, no question. But there's so much so that later, when that very pastor had some difficulties, where was it he got his healing? Came up to the village and was there for a wonderful period of time with our great young adult women who were good theologians at that moment. A Presbyterian became missionary, and Sony, who's now an ordained pastor down in Tacoma, and so on, and her gang, and they just surrounded him with love and gave him the healing he needed that hadn't come to him from the other official agencies the church has for these things. So it has tremendous power. I think of another one of the strongest pastors we have in a tremendous parish today, perhaps numerically as strong as any that we have, in the ALC, and he had a parish out here right then. He was having trouble for the gospel. There was a lot of legalism in the parish. And he said, can I just come up and rest from us? I said, sure, that's what we're here for. Come up in May. And he did.
I think
those are the things we could do as we went along. And everybody knew it. And I said, if you're ever in trouble, if you're ever kicked out of your parish, I even had a dream in which The Missouri Synod got rid of Jack Price, so I wrote him a letter. If you ever get in trouble, Jack, come on, we're here for you.
That was not answered.
No, that was not answered.
But one thing I think we've forgotten about dimension that was very important, it was before interims were had become very much a thing with the church colleges, and but PLU started coming up with biology programs with Dr. Leros,
mm-hmm.
and they were he was up there with his wonderful wife. The very first year we were there, he was a biologist.
And Jens came up too.
And Jens Knudsen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they came up because they were fascinated with the natural development in the area and all the wonderful resources. But they also they gave a wonderful Christian witness of their own because of their own heartiness and wholesomeness. And then they had a group of students who came up, and it was fascinating. Well, they wanted to start.
And we always had scientists on the faculty. That's the one thing. Rosemary Ruth had come in. She'd never known a retreat center ever in the history of the church that had so many scientists, which is true. It did. That's one thing. In fact, the first big publication which we got published in was Scientific American. And that was on Leo Bustard again.
Yeah, because it was so strong.
And then it was only the next year when we got that good publicity in Playboy that I never could mention.
But you know, PLU said they would buy surplus goods for us, you know, to begin, so we could begin to get a little supply for food. And we had real good support. It was wonderful to have this college, university out here that really was trying to give us whatever it could.
Our institutions were, overall, our church institutions were very aware of what this might mean,
yeah.
and were very strong forces. With the exception of I did a lot of my collecting in North Dakota, so Joe Knudsen at Concordia started to feel threatened a little bit, but he never called me on the carpet. But on the other hand, I never got to him either.
No, like it was competition.
Like
yeah.
It was competition with the colleges, getting money.
Whatever area you're in.
But we didn't, our money mostly was not in large quantities most of the time. It was, we did get some wonderful big gifts.
But I set it up purposely on $100, and if we could get 1,000 people giving $100 a year, we have no trouble. We got it made. And then $100 doesn't sound like you're going to rob some other institution. Or
yeah. And then a lot of our people would give, like they'd give $20, or one of the guys that was always on the volunteer for years used to tithe, and some years he wasn't making any money, and he'd send in, you know, like 57 cents one month, and $1.49 the next, and then we could always tell how he was doing, because then he.
And when Daryl and I felt we got our token for good was when a man came in a horrible blizzard, walked from Anoka into Minneapolis. It's about 20 miles. He hiked. He had heard Daryl and I speaking the week before in the Finnish sauna about Holden, what we're hoping for.
He heard them over
the. And he said, "I've been praying about it where God wants me to use $200 that I've saved. This is what I had dreamed might happen for the church." He never got to them. Very simple man. "I want you to take this money. And here were these $10, $20 bills in cash." I said, "That's my one gift as a token for good from the Lord." I never got another one like that. The mother of our wealthiest man today, he wasn't wealthy then, he just had his little store in Four City, but his mother sent me the second $100 that I got without asking for it. She said, "This is going to be a tough one, Carol. I think I want to just let you know we're behind you. Husband dearly loved me." And in fact, the first time I ever heard me preach, "Where the Lutheran Church get somebody like you?" I said, "From the Holy Spirit, of course." "Good boy," he said. Well, his son started the Winnebago, those mobile homes. And
but he wasn't very.
It wasn't the same way. He said, "Well, my third one, which I'll give is Holden Village." I said, "Don't think I'm going to wait, John. I won't hold my breath."
He had two priorities before Holden.
I hope he's fulfilled them. I had to say to him, he's worth $644 million the day he talked to me. He told me that. And he was. It was in Time Magazine, too. And he says, "Here you are, the biggest beggar in the church." You know, he's rubbing it in. And "you started a year before I started this today." He said, I got 50 pastors to put in $1,000 each, and I sold my furniture store for $50,000. We bought this plant for $100,000. And they foolishly sold out. I would have made millions. All they all sold off as soon as their 1,000 made 50,000. And he says, "Here's where I am, and this is where you are. I mean, they asked me for money." And I said, "Well," I said, "we're going to live without your money, but," I said, "I don't know how long you're going to live with it, John." I said, "I worry about you." I went to him. I said, either you learn to give it away or you're going to go to hell with it. In my usual nice, tactful way.
Yes, the tactful.
Tactful, I'm noted for.
But you always said that you felt that there was a distinct advantage to living on that sort of
edge
where you had to ask when people knew you needed them.
You know, the thing that does is that it makes you realize whether what you're doing is communicating. If it's communicating, then you can have a dialogue with them and they will give, because they know what is going on there is a valid and valuable event or experience. Whereas if you're living on endowments and big trust funds,
yeah, that's why
I really meant it.
I did not want a foundation for it. And you know how I fought it. I feel it's absolutely
there still
sick.
Isn't one.
We just I wanted to give the money to new breakthroughs, you know, the spirit, and try to make that the point. And right away a couple of board members wanted for a Bible camp. I said, no, that's no new breakthrough of the spirit. But I think I do want to have on the record just this one thing, that I never went anywhere from the very beginning where I didn't make fun of Hope. And that's one reason why I couldn't become another idolatry. I used to put it this way, wherever I talked, I said, of course you can't know if you're a real Christian unless you've been converted by Billy Graham. And if you want to be a real disciple, you've got to come to Holden Village. And I said this everywhere in the church.
You know how absolutely
so they wouldn't
crazy it would be serious. If that were true.
Just hold that up as the mm-hmm. yeah. goal.
And then people look kind of funny. But I think members of the board resented that I said this.
Well, sometimes I think they thought he was being too flippant.
But unless you can laugh at yourself and the whole...
No. Well, the thing is, the minute that becomes... I remember when a very respected and a person that we have a lot of love for was up there, and he said, you know, you should develop this. You should become an institution where you can actually... So you can actually put this into... you know who your supporters are, and they can have a real authority, and you can expect them to give, I mean, much like a college would give. And Carol said, you know, he said, I don't want to start another sect. I don't want to start a cult. He said, this has got to
be... They want to be like Casey, see, that's what he had in mind, was Casey.
But Carol said, this has got to be fragile. And he said, it's got to be so fragile that the Holy Spirit can move it out anytime it becomes... It is no longer useful in the kingdom. And he said, and that's why he didn't want somebody, you know, sometimes some of the youth leaders or somebody would want to come up and put on some particular program. And Carol said, it can't be that hard.
The board backed me on that too, by the way.
Yeah, they were very
strong. And the board
strong.
Said after the first terrible summer, you do the preaching. We can't take that kind of preaching up there. Because we'd had them come in and... their usual ramble, and it was
a lot of, you know, people, and people thought oh, this is an experiment, we can try anything, and it got to be nothing but try it on for size, and it didn't fit anybody.
Right.
Or they thought it could be sort of like an Atlantic Monthly come to a community, you know, and produce that. I said, you can't hardly sell Atlantic Monthly in Harper's without subsidies, and we should try to promote a community with big thing going each week to get into the national press, international eyes. So I said, this will make the international press and international eyes, but it's going to make it by being a church. We're just going to do the task in church. It'll get there. And the cast, as you know.
But I know the professional fundraisers, they are the ones that really cannot. The ones that have been up there, they will call me and they will say, do you realize what you are missing?
Uh-huh. Oh, I know.
Do you realize what?
They pulled this on me. Oh. They offered to go out. And I said, no.
Yes.
And I said, absolutely not. This lives from the hand of God or else it dies. That way. But I was still willing to pray about it and then go and tread to the door and knock on it and hope he was home and make the pitch to people that should. And yet others, I told Joel Larson, I said, you're a giving fool. I never asked you for a dime. Too many people have been picking. I said, I'm trying to find places where they haven't made a path to the door, but I don't expect you to make any money in the vehicles you're going to sell us. And he didn't. And then I did come into once when Werner was in Europe, so he couldn't stop me, and I wanted something for Phyllis Anderson there to have between Chelan and Wenatchee. I knew he liked Phyllis from being there the summer before. And I said, that Chev truck you got out there, it's one of those nice ones on the back. I said,
El Camino.
How are you today? I said, I won't ask for any money, but I think you could stand a loss. And he told Jack, who was his helper right then. He said, Jack, go out and see what's on it. It's $2,800. He said, how does $800 sound to you? So it sounded like a pretty good loss. So I came in the next day with $800 because I had authority at that time because Werner was in Europe. Somebody had authority. So I had authority over against the checking. So, and I gave it to him. And
was that?
I feel embarrassed when you're reading that because I realize. I mean, you're hearing my cries because I didn't want to go there.
Well, I
really
know,
didn't. You see,
I know,
and,
but just
and
the
they
same.
Knew this, and yet I had
I'm
no place
sorry.
Else to go, really.
I mean, the thing
and
is...
And I will admit, I still wish I hadn't been. That's
Carol,
the awful part about it.
I don't so I think do. So. I don't think that's
oh,
true.
I
mean,
do.
But I do think that the whole... that it's always good to go back to beginnings and see, you know, where it started. And maybe it... And, you know, of course it doesn't always start in the right direction. There are a lot of false starts, a lot of things that have to be changed. But... It's always good to go back and look at it from that point of view and see, now, where do we go from here? Supposing we were starting this over, what would we do differently? Or what can we do now? I think it's important to go back to beginnings. I really do.
Do you see that things have shifted?
Oh, yes.
That is good or bad?
I think good. One thing it's learned very clearly, I think, and this we didn't have at first. This is my fight with Gilbert. Gil's like my mother. He couldn't stand it. Well, when I got married to Mary, mother told Mary, don't ever let a man sit down. It's hard to get him up again. And Gil's exactly like the West Coast in Norway is a lot of energy. It's like mother. And indefatigable. He can work 20 hours and not even know he's been. So everybody up there had to work. You got to work. Well, the first summer I wasn't there, but the pastors told me how they ducked from him behind. And one bishop who never was for us from that summer on, whose daughter came up and was a dear for us, but they hid behind the dormitory so you could just get away and talk a little bit. I said, Gil, this got to be a place where if people just want chew blade glass in here, they can
the
chew
pastors glass. Came up for a pastoral conference.
And of course, he can say, why do you want a library up here? We don't have books. Nobody's going to read up here.
He would never have let Christ go out into the wilderness. He would have
well,
kept it right
he
there.
He might have let that happen. But
it was the strong feeling between us on this. I said, Gil, this is forever. This is going to be a work experiment for volunteers 100 years from now. I said, this is what it will be for the church. I said, that's one dream that Mark Leakey had. Why do you have to go over to Europe with all these kids? That's what I was doing then, building these retreat centers in Europe. Why don't we do one right here? Well, and he's wondering about Aspen or someplace like that. And I said, well, when the time comes, fine. But so far, nothing here has opened up. It's my own fault. I could have bought right where we are. And I didn't want to ruin our own privacy and had a retreat center there. And Howard's a little mad at me still for not doing it for $1,800 to pick up a whole farm, the farm buildings, everything else. And the man was offered $2,400. Darling guy, one of the great princes of God. And he still wouldn't sell them until I had still another chance to get over. Well, I had the money, but I didn't want to have other people swimming in our pool. That was pure selfishness.
Yeah.
But that could have made a retreat center. So then, after my first term, when I didn't know what it'd be like for a second term, we did go down and investigate another retreat on North Shore for $85,000. It is now actually being used that way, interesting enough, after it's made a success as a private one. And there are other places where people can do things differently that I'm so grateful is happening. And there are places, I think, in the Lutheran Church, maybe to have a monastery for Lutheran monks or Lutheran nuns, like Daisy is.
Or like John is thinking about with his third order. Yeah,
and like somebody's thinking about up in Canada. And I'm wide open to those things, but I didn't think the village was it. It was a place where there'd been some honest work. I remember Johann asked me once when the men came back who had first tested the whole thing. And be all Swedes. They were Lutherans, the first engineers up there. The ones when they were the ones whose first honeymoon ridge, where the
they got up and
where the slides came
and
knocked
gold.
And they knocked out their knocked out their dwellings. And they had a rough time. And he was saying he used some big words about it, kind of. But he mentioned that all that trial and error, that sweat and blood and that grief they had was worth it. That this might happen now.
He said, this might have been God's purpose,
this was God's purpose
for the whole mining event.
And
was this retreat?
And Johann whispered to me, he was in high school at times, said, do you believe that, Dad? I said, believe it. I'm here because this was used as a mine.
Believe
I said,
it.
If this materials hadn't been available for armed forces, I wouldn't be here.
No,
he said, I thought you felt that way. I said, sure I do. Well, then when they wanted to reopen the mine, I was 100% for it, if you recall. If you're on the board then, I thought this would be great because I get along with those people.
Yes, but
I have a hard time getting along with some people, but not those people.
But the only problem
the noise.
The problem with having a mine there was absolutely impossible.
With the noise.
I think Carol thought, well, if they decide to open the mine, we'd make enough money so we could move it to someplace else.
No, I didn't either, but I thought it could work out.
Let's not talk about
the other part of it, I'll admit, was always there and it still is there. because I am a citizen of this country, and I think we too have a mission, and we've got a responsibility to it. And in a world in which it is, wretched as it is, I can't, much as I can cheer the guys who think we should all, and Christians, go for the peace movements, I still can't say I can. And I'm not a peace man to begin with, so it'd be kind of phony if I opted for that, maybe.
You can hope that sometime...
Sure, I hope might, but I'm so grateful that we have there made something that if war came, we know it's going to open up again. And it's all there ready to be used. And I even wrote the military, and I said, you need some emergency field, land in sometimes. We just had the mayor of Seattle lost in an accident somewhere up there, they're Chinese.
Yes, I remember.
And I said, if there had been a landing field up here, he might have been saved. I said, why don't you put in an emergency field up? You can do it while we're here. Don't, nobody has to know. It'll be another secret landing field. I said, we certainly aren't going to tell anybody. I actually wrote the military.
It was before it had become a nuclear problem.
Because I thought maybe they could level it off and make it in. But I was glad for that. It was useful for, and I said, every dollar that I collect from the Lutherans is for all the people of God. And the Jews never were made to feel like they didn't belong there, as you know.
Yeah.
I would have been happy to take a rabbi in residence, but they said, if he's in residence, he can't join in worship. I said, I mean, we're listening, but he isn't. Well, I said, I'm sorry, everybody in our community is listening to each other.
Well, and the thing is, you can't...
was the Anti-Defamation League. They wrote me right away and were willing to support a rabbi up there, because they realized this thing would go. The Jews could see that immediately. How come I can't come? See, I said, God just hasn't given us imagination. Or maybe I feel bad because more and more I'm convinced the Holy Spirit is the imagination of the new man, at least the new woman. The Holy Spirit is the imagination there. Sometimes I wonder if we so quench the Spirit, tame, we think we're in control of the Holy Spirit. Well, there's a tendency amongst us sometimes.
Whether he will.
Yeah, but these breakthroughs come, and they come through crazy people and people who are fanatic, and I'm grateful that the Lord produces them from generation to generation.
What would you say were shifts that you maybe hadn't anticipated, or ones that you did that occurred in the time that you were there?
Well, one of the good ones I didn't anticipate, I suppose, is when I really wouldn't have to ask for money anymore. I was glad that time came, where it was just going. That's when I could be there in the wintertime. It was fun. I never realized they would develop a winter program like it did. And that, again, is John Graber and Werner. They shared a vision there together I didn't share. And I did not get John up there. The board thought I did.
Carol
thinking that that could develop into something for the winter, which it did.
Although Carol did feel that that we, if we were going to have, if the village was going to be open in the winter with anybody there, you really had to do something to make some money. And Carol never believes that you can live on nothing. Mm-hmm. And he felt that you can't be, you've got to support yourself up there. And so he did think that if there was a possibility of some kind of school or something, that maybe, I think that's why he went along with it, because he thought that, well, this would make it, there would be some rationale for our keeping the village open and having and having to use our extra plant, which we were having to plan to use. And that was a lot of money.
But fail the worst, I'd say, of anything that I really had hoped from the beginning it could be. I thought it could be a place for faculties from our colleges coming in, you know, afford sabbaticals and come in. They were bad news overall.
They did come, but
they were hard on Werner. They were critical all the time. So Werner, one reason Werner might keep the state boys up there is because they picked on the state boys instead of him, you know. And they were never very grateful. And when Werner didn't say enough, being thanks for somebody who'd made a spinning wheel or something, I thought, my goodness, we'd taken a husband, wife, and three kids the whole year that I had to run like money to feed them. And then we were supposed to be gracious and so thankful to them. Well, Werner admitted, but he didn't get overflowing about it. That whole group became, well, I mean, that's part of my final dismissal.
Well, I think too, though, that the... I think one of the main problems with sabbaticals is that a lot of people do not think about sabbatical as a place where you do studying. They think about it more in terms of a place where there's a certain amount of prestige that you've been there. And
is this an academic kind of
thing? Yeah.
See, now what I'd hoped is that eventually our church might buy the sabbatical from the Old Testament. I think it makes great difference. I think rather than fighting for a 4-day week, we ought to fight for 1 year off every 7. And then we can get plumbers and bricklayers and farmers and so on up there for a sabbatical. We have had a few that have come up there for some periods of time like that. And they've been gracious and wonderful. and they've got something to do with their hands, and at the same time they're refreshed in their minds and they respond to the program and they're excited about it. For the rest, this doesn't come up to what happens at a faculty meeting, perhaps. I don't know.
But this is really what the, see, this is what the Danish folk school started out to be, because the man, this old Grundtvig, realized that the Danish farmers had this period of time in which they couldn't do any real farming because of the winter, and so he realized they were, the Germans on the other side of the Schleswig-Holstein border were all of them so up in their education, they could read and write, and the Danish farmers at that time were not well schooled. That was in the 19th century. And so he started the Danish folk school movement with the out of the Christian, he was a Christian pastor, out of this whole sense of need of these people who were stout, strong lay people who were Christians, baptized and confirmed in the church, but who had not been educated beyond, you know, maybe primary school. Mm-hmm. And so they learned a lot of things. They learned to be proud of their country. They studied Danish literature, Danish history, the Danish language, and geography. And then they always had Bible study and church history. And then they also did weaving and did things with their hands. And then had kinds of real nice carpentry.
Where's your car parked? Is there a time
situation? It was 2 hours.
I wasn't buying lousy cars. They look good.
But what,
they just didn't get you home.
No.
But one thing, I remember another very strong thing that he says here, and this was way back, you know, in the first year. My first friendly group to Holden, where commitment is in the past, has cheered my soul. The Lutheran Council of Greater Seattle. Now I go to the Inland, Inland Empire pastors of the American Lutheran Church, our strategic support group. If I can swing them to a congregational canvas, we are on our way. My despair is lifting. At times, I felt the joke was stale. At least I could not laugh at it. Now I can again get distance to myself and approach more in God's humor in using me.
Well, that's been my life of discipline and fine humor, I call it. Well, Aubrey Edmund introduced me, you know, and says, well, as we all know, we got Hinderly, the fanatic of the ELC, now he's out with us in the village, and we're going to have to get behind him, you know. And that's just how he introduced me. But I got nowhere, of course, in the next mission, and they could do anything. And in fact, that particular synodical president from this area apologized for writing me a scolding letter, lady, because I suggested that maybe they could reintroduce their Ascension Days by having a breakfast and communion. All I did in my churches. I said, and have an offering. I said, only be very small, and you can send $2 from that offering to Holden Village. That's all I asked for, and he was furious. No right to ask congregation for any money. That was the LCD. Well, if you can't get it there, what can you give it? So I couldn't, and it took some years before the board had an official motion that I was allowed to collect money for Holden Village. That did not happen for the first 7 or 8 years. So I was all alone, and this was the whole grief of it, see. And nobody cared. When we reset the board and did it up differently, then things changed. Leo was behind that reorganization. It's stupid to have people on the board unless they personally are contributing to the place and at least know what is there. They'd come in to be a Supreme Court and move out again. That's all. There's no sense of support. There's no sense of friendliness.
And any judgment there isn't valid. If a person isn't suffering and praying for a place, they don't have any right to
it. It was just crazy. Yeah, we. in fact, one of them got so angry at me, and he was a man, officer of one of our food companies that Elmer put on the board, and he really, his feelings were hurt, because Werner and I were saying that why don't we just go out and get drunk after this meeting, there's nothing else to do to something like this but to dismiss it that way. Well, we never had either one of us, but it was really bad, it was so bad. And in fact, Elmer was so sympathetic after the first board meeting we had in Minneapolis, because Mary and I went over then to one of our parishes, which was wanting to call us. Grace Lutheran in Eau Claire, and I have about 5,000-6,000 members, and it would be a busy ministry. And she did call a second, third cousin of mine there, but we had had this beautiful prayer for unity from a man on the board who was Missouri Synod pastor, and then right afterwards a motion that we would not be allowed to have communion there, and so on. And Elmer looked at me and says, "Would you ever understand us?" I said, "Norm, it's hard for me. I'm going over to Eau Claire on Sunday, and I think I'm through." I said, "I don't think I can take this." Well, I went over there, and then what I did, I came back and I wrote the board letter. I said, "I refuse, as last summer, the very first summer, to have communion under a chalet or back in a messed up room where they used to play cards and just junk in there now, so that nobody could be offended and we could have communion together who sought it." And furthermore, one of the Lutheran pastors furious at me because he had been permitted to know, and he had some youth up that he would have wanted there, and I couldn't even let it be known. This is simply sort of a secret communion within the community for the workers. I had to lay in a hand service to start right away because people said, "How do you sustain the motivation up there?" Well, I said, "Really, the issue hasn't come up," and it hadn't. We never had trouble with motivation. I said, "This place is built for crisis." I say, "It's got a casual excellence that responds every time there's a need." And it did. The kids would go out and sleep on the lawn and give up their beds to people coming in.
We were too full and didn't have supplies.
And it was terrific to see it there. And I had nothing, anything but good, but they deserved to have communion. And I just wrote the boy, the letter I wrote the boy, I said, "It's too far to swim to Chelan. We have no other access, and we have to have communion here, and I'm going to have it." Well, the member of the board, not this pastor, he never ever relented on it. The faith, you might say, was their point. But another layman said, "We'll agree to look the other way." Well, when I told this to Skisgård in Denmark, he got up, walked around his table. "Oh," he says, "oh my God, I don't know if I could be a Lutheran in America." He says, "How can you have a retreat that doesn't start in communion, you see?" Well, this is the European understanding. You start as one body, you start in communion. Then you have all the differences you want mentally when you are seeking one glory and one Lord. You can confront some of these things and let them come into the open. And that's just what happened at the village, of course.
Well, 2 years ago, the board made a specific request that we always start on Sunday so that they can have communion together. And then no matter where it goes, you are.
We always started that.
Exactly.
We did.
Exactly.
But now they made it a board request.
Because they requested, it wasn't like formal motion,
no.
But they said, "Can you, when you schedule it so that we come in on the Sunday?"
Oh, for the board meeting?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So they said they always felt like it was not complete. Oh, so okay. Something that you did or that you
well,
got
we always
got
had,
to them.
See, we always had communion as a beginning because Carol felt that...
Well, we didn't. See, we had it secretly. Well, the first public communion, Paul Hayton and I had it together. And he's an ordained Missouri clergyman. And he doesn't remember, nor do I, which one preached and which one celebrated. I have a hunch he may have preached and I celebrated. But we don't remember, I don't. That was the first time. We had it on the 4th of July. Freedom from the Gestapo.
And it wasn't, remember, this wasn't just Missouri.
No, LCA wouldn't allow it because they weren't in a church.
And then there were a lot of ALC synods who didn't believe in having communion at what, quote, Bible camps.
Yeah.
I mean, they thought this was taking it out of the church.
Yeah. And we still didn't have a congregation.
And so also, they thought it was, people kept referring to it as a camp, and instead of a retreat center. And we used to come to blows with people because we tried to get it clear to them, it was not a camping place. This is a retreat center where you come for a specific reason, and it takes time, it takes a little money, but you do it because it has a priority. Well, you know, it's hard to make people, I spend so much time on the telephone in Minneapolis, because to explain it to the people in the Midwest who had never been out here, a lot of people from the West say, "Oh, well, it must have been nothing to sell it to the Midwest. After all, they love to come to the mountains." I said, "Yes, but they didn't want to come by way of a ferry boat that they had never heard of Lake Chelan, and they couldn't find it on the map, and they didn't know." And then after you got on that, then you had to take another boat, and what did you do in your car? What kind of clothes do you take along with you? It was all, I mean, it didn't seem to make any difference how many brochures we sent out. They had to hear, a lot of the people had to hear it by word of mouth.
Well, for Lake Chelan itself in the state of Washington, I think, for instance, the Tri-Cities prayer breakfast asked me to address them in the morning. This is one of the things I started to use, and so I was getting non-Lutherans more and more coming through that vehicle. And at that breakfast, I was speaking about Holden Village, and they did not know where Lake Chelan was, and there, same way Walla Walla. They did not know where Lake Chelan was. A lot of people there. It was their own state. Well, if you can't in your own state have this problem,
but you see, but I can see why, because that was a wilderness area that people went to who liked to go hiking. Well, if you didn't like to go hiking, you know, if you were into boating or golfing or RVs, I mean, there wasn't that, because it wasn't that good for, unless you stayed in a motel at the end of the lake where it was warm, then you could, you know, end Chelan.
And you still had, I think, one dear guy whom I respect deeply. He sent up a letter describing each person coming from his parish that year and what he expected to happen for them at the village and what he did not expect to happen to them at the village. But I could amen that. I knew his concern. He was getting the leadership group in his parish, and they were the leadership group, no question about it. And able guys. One was a doctor, and the other one had was selling mobile homes of a certain kind after he had a big business. Differed with his partner and access to Jesus Christ. Decided a non-Christian and a Christian couldn't unite in a business very easily. And said, "You name the price for which you'll buy it up, and I'll buy it from you." Well, he wanted to buy it, okay. He was out there. We had a good group from that. It was a powerful area for us, actually. But it's an area where I've had preaching missions in both of the main churches, one former Danish, one ours, as well as in the area around. And then you finally got them coming. It was interesting. And the strength went back, no question. But there's so much so that later, when that very pastor had some difficulties, where was it he got his healing? Came up to the village and was there for a wonderful period of time with our great young adult women who were good theologians at that moment. A Presbyterian became a missionary, and Sony, who's now an ordained pastor down in Tacoma, and so on, and her gang, and they just surrounded him with love and gave him the healing he needed that hadn't come to him from the other official agencies the church has for these things. So it has tremendous power. I think another one of the strongest pastors we have in a tremendous parish today, perhaps in America, as strong as any that we have, in the ALC, and he had a parish out here right then. He was having trouble for the gospel. There was a lot of legalism in the parish. And he said, "Can I just come up and rest from us?" I said, "Sure, that's what we're here for. Come up in May." And he did.
I think
those are the things we could do as we went along. And everybody knew it. And I said, if you're ever in trouble, if you're ever kicked out of your parish, I even had a dream in which the Missouri Synod got rid of Jack Price, so I wrote him a letter. If you ever get in trouble, Jack, come on, we're here for you.
That was not answered.
No, that was not answered.
But one thing I think we've forgotten about to mention that was very important, it was before interims were had become very much a thing with the church colleges, and but PLU started coming up with biology programs with Dr. Leros.
Mm-hmm.
And they were up, in fact, he was up there with his wonderful wife. The very first year we were there, he was a biologist.
And Jens came up too.
And Jens Knudsen?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they came up because they were fascinated with the natural development in the area and all the, you know, the wonderful resources. But they also, they gave a wonderful Christian witness of their own, because of their own heartiness and wholesomeness. And then they had a group of students who came up, and it was fascinating. Well, they wanted to start.
And we always had scientists on the faculty. That's the one thing. Rosemary Ruth had come in. She'd never done a retreat center ever in the history of the church that had so many scientists, which is true. It didn't. That's one thing. In fact, the first big publication which we got published in was Scientific American. And that was on Leo Bustad again. And then it was only the next year when we got that good publicity in Playboy that I never could mention.
but you know, PLU said they would buy surplus goods for us, you know, to begin, so we could begin to get a little supply for food. And we had real good support. It was wonderful to have this college, university out here that really was trying to give us whatever it could.
Our institutions were, overall, our church institutions were very aware of what this might mean, and were very strong forces. With the exception when I did a lot of my collecting in North Dakota, so Joe Knudsen at Concordia started to feel threatened a little bit, but he never called me on the carpet. But on the other hand, I never got to him either.
No, like it was competition.
Like it was competition with the colleges, getting money.
Whatever area you're in.
But we didn't, you know, our money mostly was not in large quantities most of the time. It was, we did get some wonderful big gifts.
But I set it up purposely on $100, and if we could get 1,000 people giving $100 a year, we have no trouble. We got it made. And then $100 doesn't sound like you're going to rob some other institution.
Yeah. And then a lot of our people would give, like they'd give $20, or one of the guys that was always on the volunteer for years used to tithe, and some years he wasn't making any money, and he'd send in, you know, like 57 cents 1 month, and $1.49 the next, and you know, then we could always tell how he was doing, because then he, you know.
And when Daryl and I thought we got our token for good was when a man came in a horrible blizzard, walked from Anoka into Minneapolis. It's about 20 miles. He hiked. He had heard Daryl and I speaking the week before in the Finnish sauna about Holden, what we're hoping for.
He said,
I've been praying about it, where God wants me to use $200 that I've saved. This is what I have dreamed might happen for the church. He never got to it. Very simple man. I want you to take this money. And here were these $10, $20 in cash. I said, that's my one gift as a token for good from the Lord. I never got another one like that. The mother of our wealthiest man today, he wasn't wealthy then, he just had his little store in Forest City, but his mother sent me the second $100 that I got without asking for it. She said, this is going to be a tough one, Carol. I think I want to just let you know we're behind you. Husband dearly loved me. And in fact, the first time I ever heard me preach, where the Lutheran Church get somebody like you? I said, from the Holy Spirit, of course. Good boy. Said, well, his son started the Winnebago, those mobile homes. And
but he wasn't very...
wasn't the same way. He said, my third one, which I'll give is Holden Village. I don't think I'm going to wait, John. I won't hold my breath.
He had two priorities before Holden.
I hope he's fulfilled them. I had to say to him, he's worth $644 million the day he talked to me. Told me that. And he was. He was in Time Magazine, too. And he says, here you are, the biggest beggar in the church. You know, he's rubbing it in. And you started a year before I started this today. He said, I got 50 pastors to put in $1,000 each, and I sold my furniture store for $50,000. We bought this plant for $100,000. And they foolishly sold out. I would have made millionaires and all. They all sold off as soon as their 1,000 made 50,000. And he says, here's where I am, and this is where you are. I mean, they asked me for money. And I said, we're going to live without your money, but I said, I don't know how long you're going to live with it, John. I said, I worry about you. And I really am. I said, either you learn to give it away or you're going to go to hell with it. In my usual nice tactful way.
Yes, the tactful.
I'm noted for.
But you always said that you felt that there was a distinct advantage to living on that sort of
edge
where you had to ask if people knew you needed them.
You know, the thing that does is that it makes you realize whether what you're doing is communicating. If it's communicating, then you can have a dialogue with them and they will give, because they know what is going on there is a valid and valuable event or experience. Whereas if you're living on endowments and big trust funds,
yeah, that's why
I really meant it.
I did not want a foundation for it, and you know how I fought it. I feel it's absolutely
there still
sick.
Isn't one.
We
but
just
still,
I wanted to give the money to new breakthroughs, you know, the Spirit, and try to make that the point. And right away, a couple of board members wanted for a Bible camp. I said, no, that's no new breakthrough, the Spirit. But I think I do want to have on the record just this one thing, that I never went anywhere from the very beginning where I didn't make fun of Holden. And that's one reason why I couldn't become another idolatry. I used to put it this way, wherever I talked, I said, of course you can't know if you're a real Christian unless you've been converted by Billy Graham. And if you want to be a real disciple, you've got to come to Holden Village. And I said this everywhere in the church.
And you know how absolutely
so they wouldn't
crazy
it
would be
serious.
If that were true.
Just hold that up as a mm-hmm. goal.
And then people look kind of funny. But I think members of board resented that I said this.
Well, sometimes I think they thought he was being too flippant.
But unless you can laugh at yourself and the whole...
No.
Well, the thing is, the minute that becomes... I remember when,
mission
when a very respected and a person that we have a lot of love for was up there, and he said, you know, you should develop this. You should become an institution where you can actually... So you can actually put this into, you know who your supporters are, and they can have a real authority, and you can expect them to give, I mean, much like a college would give. And Carol said, you know, he said, I don't want to start another sect. I don't want to start a cult. He said, this has got to
they
be...
They want to be like Casey, see, that's what he had in mind, was Casey.
But Carol said, this has got to be fragile, and he said, it's got to be so fragile that the Holy Spirit can move it out anytime it becomes, it is no longer useful in the kingdom. And he said, and that's why he didn't want somebody, you know, sometimes some of the youth leaders or somebody would want to come up and put on some particular program. And Carol said, it can't be that hard.
The board backed me on that too, by the way.
Yeah, they were very strong.
And the board
strong.
Said after the first terrible summer, you do the preaching. We can't take that kind of preaching up there. Because we'd had them come in and their usual ramble. And it was
a lot of, people. And people thought, oh, this is an experiment. We can try anything. And it got to be nothing but,
shambles.
Try it on for size, and it didn't fit anybody.
Right.
Or they thought it could be sort of like an Atlantic Monthly come to a community, and produce that. I said, you can't hardly sell Atlantic Monthly in Harper's without subsidies, and we should try to promote a community with big thing going each week to get into the national press, international eyes. So I said, this will make the international press and international eyes. It was going to make it by being in church. It was going to be a task in church. It'll get there. And it has, as you know.
But I know the professional fundraisers, they are the ones that really cannot. The ones that have been up there, they will call me and they will say, do you realize what you are missing?
Uh-huh. Oh, I know.
Do you realize what?
They pulled this on me. Oh. They offered to go out. Uh-huh. I said, no. Yes. And I said, absolutely not. This lives from the hand of God or else it dies. That way. But I was still willing to pray about it and then go and tread to the door and knock on it and hope he was home and make the pitch to people that should. And yet others, I told Joel Larson, I said, you're a giving fool. I never asked you for a dime. Too many people have been picking. I said, I'm trying to find a place where they haven't made a path to the door, but I don't expect you to make any money in the vehicles you're going to sell us. And he didn't. And then I did come into once when Werner was in Europe, so he couldn't stop me, and I wanted something for Phyllis Anderson there to have between Chelan and Wenatchee. I knew he liked Phyllis from being there the summer before. And I said, that Chev truck you got out there, it's one of those nice ones in the back. I said,
El Camino.
How are you today? I said, I won't ask for any money, but I think you could stand a loss. And he told Jack, was his helper right then. He said, Jack, go out and see what's on it. It's $2,800. He said, how's $800 sound to you? I said, it sounded a pretty good loss. So I came in the next day with $800 because I had authority at that time because Werner was in Europe. Somebody had authority. So I had authority over against the checking. So, and I gave it to him. And
is that job?
I feel embarrassed when you're reading that because I realize, you're hearing my cries because I didn't want to go there.
Well,
I really
I know.
Didn't, you see.
I know,
and,
but just
and
the
they
same.
Knew this, and yet I had no place else to go, really.
I mean, the thing
and
is...
And I'll admit, I still wish I hadn't been. That's
Carol,
the awful part about it.
I don't think so. I don't think that's true. But I do think that it's always good to go back to beginnings and see, where it started. And maybe of course it doesn't always start in the right direction. There are a lot of false starts, a lot of things that have to be changed. But it's always good to go back and look at it from that point of view and see, now where do we go from here? Supposing we were starting this over, what would we do differently? Or what can we do now? I think it's important to go back to beginnings. I really do.
Do you see that things have shifted in
a
way
that
is good or bad?
I think good. One thing it's learned very clearly, I think, and this we didn't have at first, this is my fight with Gilbert. Gil's like my mother. He couldn't stand it. Well, when I got married to Mary, mother told Mary, don't ever let a man sit down. It's hard to get him up again. And Gil's exactly like the West Coast Norway is a lot of energy, just like mother, and indefatigable. He can work 20 hours and not even know he's been. So everybody up there had to work. You got to work. Well, the first summer I wasn't there, but the pastors told me how they ducked from him behind. And one bishop who never was for us from that summer on, his daughter came up and was a dear for us, but they hid behind the dormitory so you can just get away and talk a little bit. I said, Gil, this got to be a place where if people just want chew blade glass, they can
the
chew
the pastors came up for a pastoral conference.
And of course, he can say, why do you want a library up here? We don't have books. Nobody's going to read up here.
He would never have let Christ go out into the wilderness. He would have
kept
him right there.
Well, he might have let that happen. But
it was the strong feeling between us on this. I said, Gil, this is forever. This is going to be a work experiment for volunteers 100 years from now. I said, this is what it will be for the church. I said, that's one dream that Mark Leakey had. Why do you have to go to Europe with all these kids? That's what I was doing then, building these retreat centers in Europe. Why don't we do one right here? Well, and he's wondering about Aspen or someplace like that. And I said, well, when the time comes, fine. But so far, nothing here has opened up. It's my own fault. I could have bought right where we are. And I didn't want to ruin our own privacy and had a retreat center there. And Howard's a little mad at me still for not doing it for $1,800 to pick up a whole farm, the farm buildings, everything else. And the man was offered $2,400. Darling guy, one of the great princes of God. And he still wouldn't sell them until I had still another chance to get over. Well, I had the money, but I didn't want to have other people swimming in our pool. That was pure selfishness.
Yeah.
But that could have made a retreat center. So then, after my first term, when I didn't want to be elected for a second term, we did go down and investigate another retreat on North Shore for 85,000, but is now actually being used that way, interesting enough, after it's made a success as a private one. And there are other places where people can do things differently that I'm so grateful is happening. And there are places, I think, in the Lutheran Church, maybe to have a monastery for Lutheran monks or Lutheran nuns, like Daisy is.
Or like,
somebody thinking about up in Canada. And I'm wide open to those things, but I didn't think the village was it. It was a place where there'd been some honest work. I remember Johann asked me once when the men came back who had first tested the whole thing. And they all Swedes. They were Lutherans, the first engineers up there. The ones when they were the ones whose first honeymoon ridge, where the slides came and they knocked out their dwellings. And they had a rough time. And he was saying, he used some big words about it, kind of. But he mentioned that all that trial and error, that sweat and blood and that grief they had was worth it. That this might happen now.
He said, this might have been God's purpose,
this was God's purpose for
the whole mining event.
And Johann whispered to me, he was in high school at times, said, do you believe that, Dad? I said, believe it. I'm here because this was used as a mine. If this materials hadn't been available for armed forces, I wouldn't be here.
No,
he said, I thought you felt that way. I said, sure I do. Well, then when they wanted to reopen the mine, I was 100% for it, if you recall. If you're on the board then, I thought this would be great because I get along with those people.
Yes, but
I have a hard time getting along with some people, but not those people.
But the only problem with everything, you know,
the noise.
The problem with having a mine there was absolutely impossible.
The noise.
I think Carol thought, well, if they decide to open the mine, we'd make enough money so we could move it to someplace else.
No, I didn't either. But I thought it could work out.
Let's not talk about
the other part of it. I'll admit was always there and it still is there because I am a citizen of this country and I think we too have a mission and we've got a responsibility to it. And in the world in which it is, wretched as it is, I can't, much as I can cheer the guys who think we should all, and Christians, go for the peace movements, I still can't say I can. And I'm not a peace man to begin with, so it'd be kind of phony if I opted for that, maybe.
You can hope that sometimes...
Sure, I hope might, but I'm so grateful that we have there made something that if war came, we know it's going to open up again. And it's all there ready to be used. And I even wrote the military, and I said, you need some emergency fields to land in sometimes. We just had the mayor of Seattle lost in an accident somewhere up there, that Chinese.
I remember.
And I said, if there had been a landing field up here, he might have been saved. I said, why don't you put in an emergency field up? You can do it while we're here. No, nobody has to know. It'll be another secret landing field. I said, we certainly aren't going to tell anybody. I actually wrote the military.
It was before it had become a nuclear problem.
Because I thought maybe they could level it off and make it. But I was glad for that. It was useful for, and I said, every dollar that I collect from the Lutherans is for all the people of God. And the Jews never were made to feel like they didn't belong there, as you know.
Yeah.
I would have been happy to take a rabbi in residence, but they said, if he's in residence, he can't join you in worship. I said, I mean, we're listening, but he isn't. I said, I'm sorry, everybody in our community listen to each other.
Well, and the thing is,
that was anti-defamation league. They wrote me right away and were willing to support a rabbi up there because they realized this thing would go. The Jews could see that immediately. How come our gang couldn't see? I said, God just hasn't given us imagination. Or maybe I feel bad because more and more I'm convinced the Holy Spirit is the imagination of the new man, at least the new woman. The Holy Spirit is imagination there. And sometimes I wonder if we so quench the Spirit, tame, we think we're in control of the Holy Spirit. Well, there's a tendency amongst us sometimes.
Whether he will.
Yeah, but these breakthroughs come, and they come through crazy people and people who are fanatic, and I'm grateful that the Lord produces them from generation to generation.
What would you say were shifts that you maybe hadn't anticipated, or the ones that you did that occurred in the time that you were there?
Well, one of the good ones I didn't anticipate, I suppose, is when I really wouldn't have to ask for money anymore. I was glad that time came. That's when I could be there in the wintertime. It was fun. I never realized it would develop a winter program like it did. And that, again, is John Graber and Werner. They shared a vision there together I didn't share. And I did not get John up there. The board thought I did.
Carol
thinking that that could develop into something for the winter, which it did.
Although Carol did feel that that we, if we were going to have, if the village was going to be open in the winter with anybody there, you really had to do something to make some money. And Carol never believes that you can live on nothing. And he felt that you can't be, you've got to support yourself up there. And so he did think that if there was a possibility of some kind of school or something, that maybe I think that's why he went along with it, because he thought that, well, this would make it, there would be some rationale for our keeping the village open and having and having to use our extra plant, which we were having to plan to use. And that was a lot of money.
But failed the worst, I'd say, of anything that I really had hoped from the beginning it could be. I thought it could be a place for faculties from our colleges coming in, so you'd afford sabbatics and come in. They were bad news overall.
They did come, but
they were hard on Werner. They were critical all the time. So Werner, one reason Werner might keep the state boys up there is because they picked on the state boys instead of him, you know. And they were never very grateful. And when Werner didn't say enough, being thanks for somebody who'd made a spinning wheel or something, I thought, my goodness, we'd taken a husband, wife, and three kids the whole year that I had to run like Monday to feed them. And then we were supposed to be gracious and so thankful to them. Well, Werner admitted, but they didn't get overflowing about it. That whole group became, well, I mean, that's part of my final dismissal.
Well, I think too, though, that the... I think one of the main problems with sabbaticals is that a lot of people do not think about sabbatical as a place where you do studying. They think about it more in terms of a place where there's a certain amount of prestige that you've been there. And
is this an academic kind of
thing?
See, now what I'd hoped is that eventually our church might buy the sabbatical from the Old Testament. I think it makes great difference. I think rather than fighting for a 4-day week, we ought to fight for 1 year off every 7. And then we can get plumbers and bricklayers and farmers and so on up there for a sabbatical. We have had a few that have come up there for some periods of time like that. And they've been gracious and wonderful. And they've got something to do with their hands. And at the same time, they're refreshed in their minds and they respond to the program. And they're excited about it. For the rest, this doesn't come up to what happened at the faculty meeting, perhaps. I don't.
But this is really what this is what the Danish folk school started out to be, because the man, this old Grundtvig, realized that the Danish farmers had this period of time in which they couldn't do any real farming because of the winter, and so he realized they were, the Germans on the other side of the Schleswig-Holstein border were all of them so up in their education. They read, they could read and write, and the Danish farmers at that time were not well schooled. That was in the 19th century. And so he started the Danish folk school movement with the out of a Christian, he was a Christian pastor, out of this whole sense of need of these people who were stout, strong lay people who were Christians, baptized and confirmed in the church, but who had not been educated beyond, you know, maybe primary school. Mm-hmm. And so they learned a lot of things. They learned to be proud of their country. They studied Danish literature, Danish history, the Danish language, and geography. And then they always had Bible study and church history. And then they also did weaving and did things with their hands, and then had kinds of real nice carpentry.
Where's your car parked? Is there time?
Oh, it's 2 hours. Let me see. I got here at 12:31. It would be good till 2:30.
I better come down and get it.
15 minutes. 15 more. Well,
but honest, we had studied this in Norway. See, in Norway, they had these folk schools so that there's a 70-mile radius to each one, so that they can come in like during the winter and adults. Farmers, this sort of thing, and have a few weeks in church history, or their own history, folk music,
a lot of them.
And it's an interesting thing that's happened, and they have several centers like this in Germany, but not through the total picture. But this has been one of the things that was in our background when we started this. We were hoping something of this might be possible, but the village is not the place for that. You lose too much coming and going.
But still, it does have a little bit of that. That's where I think we felt the importance of a wider scope, so that you realize, like Carol always said, you know, and everybody, the first years we were up there, people always wanted to give money to a chapel. They thought we should have a beautiful chapel with a beautiful view because it was such a wonderful place.
That's where Ricky picked up this thing that Hinderly always wants to quit. Well, that was the issue. You do that, I quit.
Well, I think people knew you meant it, too. They didn't pay attention to it. And you'll be interested to know that there were some suggestions for improving the village center. And the board, I've never heard them get so eloquent on anything that you don't want to tamper with this and make it into a pseudo kind of
churchy look.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
it's fun the way it is.
Carol said, if you, he said, if this whole place isn't a chapel,
then we've missed it.
Then he said, you don't know what we're doing up here, and we've missed the whole meaning of Christianity and the incarnation.
The total sacramental life of us all in the one body is what the village is, and that's finally gotten through. And so the frequent thing I've heard, Ellen, even after my dismissal and so on, and the men at the convention down in Portland said it from the floor.
The ALC,
because about that time I got my 40th award for being 40 years in the ministry. Remember, Haugi was one from down, now he's in Portland, but he was then in down the Tri-Cities, and the other saying, thanks for giving us a model for the parish. And that's the best thing I've heard. It was fun to know that they saw that and could see it.
And that's what Cliff Lundy has said a number of times to Carol, how much it meant to him to come up there for refreshment. He said he was, when he was a pastor in Spokane, he said it was such a strength for my parish to be able to take a group up there and realize they were not going to be separated from the parish. They were going to be strengthened and have stronger resources and come back and be a strength for the parish to make it more effective.
That was good to know. I asked the newly elected Roman Catholic bishop for the Yakima Diocese when I started that, because he was there in February for 3 weeks. And I said, what are you doing up here? Soaking up enough gospel so I don't lose it when I get back to the administration. Well, the whole people of God. And that's what it was about. It was under the gospel, shaped by it, the word made flesh. Far more physical in its manifestation than many people yet can accept that Christianity is. But it is. We Lutherans, at that point, are the most earthy of all God's families in Christ. And yet, even for them, the village almost was an offense. Had saunas, etc.
Well, it's rooted in your Old Testament.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. Just flows from that. You know, one of my prime questions was why you opted for Holden rather than parish ministry. But it isn't different, because you are focusing. You are allowing a more intense focus at Holden on parish, and then.
Well, I realize that there are other, I never had a morning in a parish when I didn't have to be scolded by the Lord as I was walking to the office. I'd be praying for the nuns, they'd be taking kids into school about 7:45, I'd get over about 8:00, and already I'd prayed, if only Al Rodsted or Al Rognes could be here, you know, and the Lord would say, I put you here. Well, I'm not a pastoral type, and my professor of my college, the businessman of my manager of our college, P.O. Holland, who's a good family friend, Arnie Flott, was in line with his professorial gown on when he ran back to me in line as I was graduating. Don't be a parish pastor. Don't go into a parish. It isn't fair to a parish, Carol. You're too intense for a parish. Well, I was. And, of course, the village could absorb all of that more than I had to give. It was there. So I didn't feel that so bad, except what I miss most from the parish life is the continuous interrelationship through the week between the proclamation and the conversation and the people.
Well, and also that
you have it holding and don't.
Yeah, well, you don't. No, you don't have this. No. You have it in a parish.
You have that.
Because you see, at Holden you have a conversation, but it's a selected conversation.
Yeah.
The people who come up there are pre-selected. A parish deals with
everybody.
Mm-hmm. Holden already has a pre-selective.
There's no main street at
Holden,
you know.
Well, I mean, the people who come up there have to decide that it's worth it to take that trip.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that hard to get to church.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you
well, and that's fun of the ministry, doesn't it? I used to tell the Fathers Seminary when I taught there, because they'd already building up legends about me, and I said, remember, I only fought on one front at a time. And sure, I had a legalistic parish this last time, but I had that town so much for me that the parish didn't dare get rid of me. And, you know, and you go in, I'd go into the Greeks, they'd say, Hindley, I love you, you know. The one whole block of tavern, solid, four sides of the block, all tavern. Every Saturday night at 11:15, after I got through with my men's Bible fellowship on Saturday night, which got so big there, we had 11 different ones finally, I'd be praying for those Tarrant men and the people in them and so on, and I felt identified with them, you know, so much so that as I'd be preaching over the air, people would say, I want to move to Watertown, that must be next to heaven. I said, right where you are is next to heaven if you've got some eyes to look, because I'd see, you know, those trees that were not as tall as I was, and you go out in the night, of course, you felt you're on the rim of the world, it's all stars in front of you. Well, it's terrific. It's also terrifically bleak if one look at it that way. Well, anyway, I missed that side of it. And I'll admit that I had chances before to be a teacher, many of them. All our colleges except for PLU had asked me to teach at them. And some several times. I had a chance to be college pastor at St. Olaf. That first one, they called for that. I had lots of these chances. I had three different seminaries. One for this spot talk up in Canada. And Dr. Gullickson wrote and said, wouldn't I come to the seminary? That when they wanted me, when I was there, they didn't want me. But anyway, I said, I belong to Hurly-Burly.
They didn't know
ministry.
What they were getting.
Yeah, that's right.
You bet.
So I was glad to stay where I was. Well, he asked me simply because he says, we get all these applications all the time. And he says, invariably, your name's coming up again and again. These fathers are going to minister. You ought to be here. Well, when you're there and then people get converted in your class, that's when they don't want you around, because then you're evangelizing. I said, no, I wasn't. I just wasn't teaching as if Jesus were someplace else, that's all. But I think that's the difference.
But in teaching, you would have been contributing more narrowly to clergy.
Yes,
you
know, that's true.
Where at Holden it was more...
And this is what Shutt said at the... When he had his farewell, they had the bishops of the ALC, he had the farewell event for Shutt at Holden Village. I think it's the only time they've ever done it. I think it's the only time anybody's ever done it. I think they go out to Evergreen in Colorado or someplace now. But that year was the year of the Wenatchee Forest Fire.
That was funny.
It was so funny. But anyway, it was ghastly too in many ways. But anyway, we had a banquet for them, sort of a farewell, celebrating Dr. Shutt's. And he said, when he was, he got up to give the speech, and then he said this about the whole home. He said, you know, he said, I told Carol that I thought this was going to fail, but I thought he could handle it. And he said, I thought it would be better to have a good failure than not try it at all.
And that's when he said to all the bishops, he said, remember, you only lost by one vote on getting into the seminary, and he had all of your votes for being there.
Yeah, but then that's when he said, and I think I can't help, after being up here, realize that it was God's will for you to be here instead of at the seminary. He said, being at the seminary is one thing, but he said Holden Village is unique. There isn't any other place
like
it.
Kent Knut said we should move the whole seminary out to Holden, then we'd see things happen. You know, well, it's true, it would.
But anyway, it was kind of
relaxed atmosphere.
It was good to know that the church felt that it was, you know, that it was a valid thing, because at first they thought it was not.
And Fry, before he died, a three-page handwritten letter, just beautiful, really. Well, it's something to know.
Well,
I mean, I wasn't there just because I was a nut.
No.
He said, I wish you were in our synod so you could take my place. That's what he said.
Well, I'm
too bad you fell amongst the Norwegians. Just
I'm glad that some of those things came to you.
Oh, yeah.
Because
it was great.
When you're vulnerable and
yeah.
you're putting yourself on the line day after day, year after year, you should have some of
Well,
that
and it was hard to know, you know, because of the fact that we were always doing controversial things, and we were always having people up there that nobody liked. I mean, that
well, even after they were kicked out of headquarters, like Herb Brooklyn, and I got an angry two-page letter from a good friend that just was in this last week, so I won't mention his name, that we had Herb there, and I'd said what I had about Herb as if it was putting down him and Augsburg, etc. Well, I wasn't it. We were wide open to anybody who was hurting, you know. That's what we're there for. And who knows when he may be next.
Yeah, that's right.
This isn't that sure world, and even these experts at being con men and image men sometimes get in it, too.
And like you were saying, you had the dream about...
Jack, yeah.
Yes.
Can
I mean,
happen to anybody.
That just shows the openness.
Yeah. Oh, yes. For very much. And it's... I was so grateful that we didn't have any judgmental sense at the village. We weren't doing this out of judging a parish because it was dull or blind or something. We weren't doing this because over against the church was so conservative. We weren't doing these things for reason. We weren't doing it because people were squandering our resources elsewhere. There was no judgment or anything else. We were living a simple life with the way we did. we fixed food very well, but we didn't have expensive stuff. We could do with cheap cuts and make it taste like a gourmet kitchen, which is what happened. And it was fun. And we just enjoyed it. And I said, this is it. It's fun to have a little humor about yourself and be able to take yourself with some laughter and know we're all under the divine humor. And that's, if I ever publish this book, that's what it's about. Discipline under divine humor.
Breakthrough.
Yeah.
And to do it with...
And isn't it fun now when people go out, they make celebrating places where they go. I was so thankful Werner and Judy having that, you know, that ice cream stand. I said, you just what Paul and Carol did and Pepin.
You make a secular, a celebration in the secular. And yeah. Who should make it but Christians?
And it spreads.
If you could document all that has happened because of that place, even food service kind of things, the people that have gone into including Paul, that it has been a model in that sense too. Not just a theological model.
Right.
Well, not just.
Charles Williams has a wonderful.
I'm going down and put some money in your car now. So you could
explanation.
Relax and eat. But that's fine. Thank you for doing this. I mean, I didn't want to say too much because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings anywhere.
Well, I think we just scratched the surface.
You have to say it the way it was.
You know where
it
was.
It's on the north side. Remember that street we went down the alley before? It's almost exactly the same place.
Right over here.
The north end of the building.
What I was thinking of was Charles Williams has a good definition of what an image is, and I'm not talking about image men or image making, but image in the literary sense. And his idea was that an image in instead of allegory or metaphor or anything like that, an image is when that person or a situation has a life of its own. It is going along being what it is. But it also has another way of being interpreted so that it can be explained if you look at it in another way. And that's where he felt that, for instance, in Dante and the Inferno, I mean, a lot of these things were images, but they were describing lives of their own, or his novels. They were N.C.S. Lewis's books. They were all stories that had an intrinsic plot value, entertainment value, were exciting by themselves. They were having a good time or having a bad time, but I mean, they had a life of their own.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, if you wanted to, you could interpret it as being more than what was going on there. And that's where I think the village had a position as far as the parish was concerned. We weren't trying to be a model parish. We were a bunch of people who were living together during a certain period of time under certain disciplines, but we were celebrating a lot of things that were difficult, but we were able to come through them with the hilarity of the Holy Spirit. And the hilarity isn't always a giggle. It sometimes comes as a long time later chuckle that comes and you realize, well, you know, I understand now how God was working this out. But that through this, we didn't plan to be a model, as I say, or a role for a parish, but the parish could see us as a possibility of different ways in which they could appropriate what was going on up here. Not to lift the whole thing over and say, well, this is a pattern for the parish, mm-hmm. but simply to interpret each person or each group of people could interpret it in his or her own way and take what they felt as groups or as individuals was something that was nourishing to them to make their living in Christ a more valiant and strength-producing kind of thing for the people in their society. One of the things that Carol had written down, the importance of having a place where people could really learn what it was to be living Christians in the structure of the society, within the structure of the society. And I realized how few people that you talk to had thought about the structure of our American society in the 60s. And we went through this whole period of Vietnam. and to try to give people who came up there just battling against the what they call the draft resistors, and then the people who were, some of them were going to Vietnam. Well, you know, how do you, I mean, can you accept both those groups?
Is there
Are you allowed to accept them? Does God accept them, or does he say only the draft resistors or only the loyal soldiers can come up or can, you know, into the kingdom? And I think this is something that Carroll really struggled for, because he always believed the gospel lives by controversy. But we did feel that if you're going to have controversy, you have to be able to disagree. And if you shut out the people who don't agree with you, then you've got a lot of people who, it used to bother me so much, because for a while, a lot of people, there was a whole generation of girls and men and women, coming out of our colleges who would nod their heads before you even finished saying what you were saying. And I'd get so mad, because I think, how can you agree with me? You don't even know what I'm saying yet. And I'd almost feel like throwing a monkey wrench into the conversation.
It's maddening when someone affirms you before they know what they're affirming.
I mean, they're already saying, yeah, I know what you mean. And I always think, when I said that to Mary Lett once, and she was only, you know, she was 14 and I was considerably older. And I said, oh, Mary Lett, I know just what you mean. I know just what you're going through. And she looked at me and she said, you don't know what I mean, Mother, and you don't know what I'm going through. How can you? I'm me. And she said, you're not my age. And I thought, thank God for feisty children.
Who tell us what we don't want to hear.
Yes, right.
But Holden is authentic as in itself. And if you look at it as being a role kind of mm-hmm. thing, then it becomes a phony. You have to be something mm-hmm. rather than what you
and that's
are.
That's what there was a real, strong attempt, as I say, with these experiments, that they were going to sort of have kind of experiments an experiment in this or that of some kind of living or some kind of worship, a lot of experiments.
Very self-conscious.
And it was so self-conscious. It isn't nearly so self-conscious now. I mean, now it's become, there's a lot more of it. But people all thought we were self-conscious already up there, just because we were discussing things that a lot of people thought was, that's sort of, you know, highbrow. Oh, that's intellectual. And I really had to do a lot of arguing with people to make them realize that you don't have to be any more intellectual than you want to be. And you don't have to go to anything that you don't want to go to. And the gospel is always understandable. So you don't have to get into these discussions in Koinonia, and you don't have to go to anything else for that matter. But it took a lot of work, because that was one of the things that people sort of shied away from. When they realized that gradually that they could come up there and they could ask questions and not be considered foolish, no matter how dumb the question seemed to be, then that word finally got around and they felt more at ease about it. But
of course, for me, having the leveler of sweatshirts, that kind of thing, enabled me to ask the things, because when you're in a group and you know so-and-so is a PhD and mm-hmm. somebody else, that's their field of expertise, then to have the courage, it takes more than I have.
That's right. Well, you know, we found out that there were a number of pastors who did not want to come up there because they were non-entities. They were simply human beings. Mm-hmm. And they really resisted that feeling of being, of not being. Carroll, don't put that melon on.
Right.
Because I'm going to.
That's true. Even for dear people like Al Robinson, Art Horson would, you know, confess to this.
Well, a lot of dramatics.
That's,
you know,
ego
so makes
kind
it
of
fun,
though,
yeah.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Oh, yes.
Well,
and but there
like
were a
being
lot
called
of,
Santa Claus.
But there were, oh, yeah. But there were a lot of just regular pastors that felt that when they lost their pastoral prefix, they kind of lost their identity. And mm-hmm. but in it it took a while, and then
it was very good that
it was freeing when they finally realized that this, they were, you know, welcome to the human race.
And I think all these dear people had in the faculty who could not get used to not having set up like a dean's office in a college and so on.
Every
and
time we'd have a program meeting.
Thanking me before they left. And I suppose the classic example of that is one of your dear friends and mine who begged for permission to give his lectures and not be interrupted. That was Walt. And I said, okay, go ahead. Because he had to be with pastors in southern Wisconsin. It was a toughie for him right then, because he was controversial then in Missouri. And then at the end of the week, he says, don't ever let me do that again.
Well, you know,
it was interesting how it come out. The kind of communication where there's give and take and interruption. It was very hard. One of the others that we have let be incommunicado on this and didn't mention who he is, but he was furious when he was interrupted. And that was the best thing in the world for him.
During the lecture? Yeah, yes. Carol finally interrupted him.
It was good that he was. And he finally, I think, came to appreciate it, that there was a communication that isn't communication. You're just hypnotizing people.
I remember this wonderful Ivar Ivas, who was just a great person from the the Baltic states. He was, he and his wife came up. He was a professor at St. Olaf then, and he translated poetry from Estonian and Latvian, and she wrote our wonderful little booklet on the sauna. And when he came up, he was absolutely startled. Because he wasn't treated academically. This was way back in the 60s, you know. And he just didn't know how to manage this. And he sort of wondered if maybe they should go home, that maybe this wasn't, you know, they didn't know whether they could handle it. Well, it was just such a wonderful experience for us and for them. They were just a great pair. And he came out of it. He said, this is the closest to being at home since I left Latvia and Estonia and Finland.
Well, the relaxation to have real conversation was so great for it.
And it was the first time he had wanted to go to communion. The first time he said, and Astrid said this too, and she's just equally wonderful. And she said they'd been at St. Olaf, but they still had not felt at home. They felt like it was a kind of a removed kind of a relationship. But they really felt like we belonged in the same world up there. And it was
wonderful.
It was a
wonderful
experience.
And that totality was what helped. See, this is where even youth officers, the fellows who were my friends, said, don't have a sauna. You must get a sauna. Dave says, get you in trouble. Well, sauna's gotten pictured in American society like it's something, some rose to sex, you know. And I said, without that, it won't be community. I said, this will be part of the whole picture that we
of
are
of course, these people they realized so much of what it meant. And so they
that's why I mentioned, because they were ones who helped the others in the community to see this.
Well, they did a lot with explaining what it meant culturally and ritually for the people of the North. But the other thing was, now he was a man who had not been very much in the church, because church in Europe isn't that, they'd been in a lot of flux because it was during the war. And but he gave there was a little group of people up under Conrad Thompson had brought a few people up, a few of the men, people up for evangelism.
Right. And said something nice. We've already credited him for paying my way for those first dreadful years. It was beautiful of him to do. But when he finally got to the village, he says, you can't fail evangelism here. You've got 100 doors. No. Well, it's this totality of the human life in which you bear the witness to Jesus. And not one place was dedicated to that.
That's
go ahead, Mary.
Right. But anyway,
I wanted to mention that, so he's given that credit
because
in the line.
Who would really never be caught. Wait, he couldn't be. He wouldn't be caught dead in the evangelism meeting. But they asked him, or Carol, I think, asked him if he would talk to these ministers about preaching, how to brighten their, how to make their preaching more living. And he did such a great job of that, you know, helping them see how to pay attention to what was going on in the town, in the ground, to look at the ground as if they were poets, to look at the sky as if they were poets, to look at people as if they were dramatists, to look at people as if they were living actors. He said, you know, he said, everything in life is what you're supposed to be preaching out from when you preach the gospel. And you know, and then he also had a wonderful, session on poems, on poetry, making haikus. And these old ladies and old men were up there. I mean, some of them, there were some young ones too, but there were some old, and they wrote such wonderful haikus. I still think that some of those early years were jewels.
The creativity that just flowed.
Because they had thought they'd lost it. And it was there.
The people,
so the intensity,
yeah,
of the joy of discovery.
Exactly.
And they didn't expect it, because they didn't think, they didn't know Holden had this. And they were just...
Came with surprise.
And it was so much fun, because now I think we take it for granted, but what used to just amaze me was, we'd come up under the tree for morning coffee, and we never had anything but coffee, because we never had any money to have anything but coffee. And that was, you know, the first 10 years. Not 10, it was in the 60s mostly. But anyway, what I loved was, you would be so busy talking to this person or that person about what you'd been listening to, and you'd keep on talking, and then you'd, you know, go off and maybe, you know, not see that person for another, you know, maybe for a day or two, maybe not at all, and you never knew their name. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know who they were, where they came from, if they were working, if they were, well, most of them were retired, but I mean, you didn't know anything about them. You were so busy talking with them with this conversation of ideas, and I thought, it was just like something.
You'd move right into that.
Yeah.
Without all of the
Without any kind of, you know, little group encounter thing where you, each one goes around and says what she or he does and where their, what their business is, if they have one, or what their likes are, or, I mean, none of that.
Get right to the heart of it.
You came right into the business of what you were there for.
And our particular confidence in this throughout sprang completely from the word of the Lord, and the understanding of it in its detail, word by wordness, had been in our lifelong Greek discipline. That the word that was given to me for the village, when I said yes and I do it, was Jesus Christ is manifest to destroy the works of the devil. And the works of the devil in the New Testament language are mataitos, emptiness, boredom, meaninglessness. The Holy Spirit is the imagination of the church. He's the one who restores the image of God to us in forgiveness, in going without guilt, in walking erect as sons of God. One of the first wonderful poems I saw, was a perpetual poem for the village, was that one of
George
Utek's, about not walking like a question mark, but like an exclamation mark, you know? Once Gerard Manley Hopkins became our sort of official poet, we again and again and again were with him, and summer after summer, never ever weary of him. The way in which it restored language and freshness and excitement, because God has made us all in his image, and there are none without imagination. There are different amounts in intelligence, but I'm convinced there's not a different amount of imagination. Everybody has it. And you listen to the simplest of people sometimes, and it opens up stuff that's been clouded for you by phrases and too much books and too much knowledge, as we all know. And in every society this happens again and again, where some of the refreshers for the society are those who've had quite a simple life, but their imagination.
Someone like a Horty.
Yeah. Horty. Yeah. Horty was the spirit of the village, and his one phrase, if we understood this place, we'd have spoiled it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right on. Right on. Then we would have made it into a little cult and idolatry. Mm-hmm. Then we went into patent it and hand it around like the Bible studies were being done right then. They had there are certain ones, right? There's a Bethel series, and you know, this is the way to do it. There's no a way to do it. There are as many ways as there are people who allow the scripture to be open to them. So, and the people out there realize it belonged to them. They weren't being pushed. No one ever got pushed. Except within the worker community, if they weren't drawing their pay, then I'd get a little bit upset with them. Because after all, I said, your pay is the faculty, and you've got to knock off from work to collect your pay. Because things are going to get done here anyway. Take what's interesting to you and go to it. I said, sometimes your crew boss, you'll have to ask him because there's something going right there. He can't let you go. But ordinarily, this is there because this is your wages for the summer, is getting in with the community conversation, because you are shaping the community. You're part of it. And if you aren't responding to it, you're misshaping it, you see.
And unless you have that depth to the community that comes in your volunteer staff, you
miss
the shallowness.
Oh, yes.
You miss it. Then it turns into a reserve.
Well, and you see, that makes a difference in the way the community
then
feels.
Then you have fatigue. And fatigue is the wrath of God. That's the best thing Turney ever said. Fatigue is the wrath of God. Then they get tired of their work. Then they're tired. Then they need release from that. And then you get into the drinking and the drugs and all the rest of our society.
See, what time is your...
I put it...
4:15.
Yeah, but no, is
lunch.
That when you have to be in Bellevue? You have to sit down and eat one little bit of food.
Yes, there's plenty of time in your car.
You can keep on talking
to Carol. Mary, I do think I would like some of those things that are from the journal.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll copy them out.
Without Carol's embarrassment.
Yeah, and I also have... and I also have a wonderful, I think, was an excellent prognosis that he did with the youth leaders on what he thought Holden should be in terms of the future.
That was in Chicago.
I thought it was excellent, and I'll find it.
Because it isn't only looking back, as Mary said, you learn, what is that one quote about, unless you learn from your...
That's true. And it was wonderful in the sense that because it was so simple, changing the name from dorms to lodges was an essential thing, so they didn't think it was a camp. But beyond that, we didn't do much else, you know. It was just what had been there as a mining community, and then we could mine the other riches that God gives us. And that's what's very real about it. And I think everybody felt like they were more part of it because you didn't have to, it didn't take you days and days and days to feel like you came in. Like nobody realizes when they go to St. Olaf College, they own it. It's too immense, it's too wealthy, how can I own this? If they don't own it, who does? It isn't owned by a board, it's owned by the church. But up there, everybody felt they owned it, you know, it just came to them.
And how do you continue to do that when a lot of the things have been done? Like I remember Jim, the first year we were up there, Bob Lilly and he built a railing.
Yes!
And he is still so proud that is still there, and yet it is something that was so...
He did, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, right.
And a feeling of worship. But when you have all of your railings built, what do you do?
I think when we were putting up that high line to bring the electricity into the village, and the pole fell over, and Paul fell over on Paul and myself, we happened to be just lucky, it was a ditch that went over the top of us. I never went past that place in winter skiing any time, but I thought about that day.
I remember.
And all Paul said... Anybody lucky enough to get a picture of this? He's just hoping somebody got a picture of it when it happened. I was just glad I was alive.
Right. Say, Carol.
Yes.
Tell her what happened with
Elaine, we've been celebrating her becoming a crew boss over here with all those men.
She got it, by the way. Did you know that?
Oh, did she get a
she's a supervisor.
She was telling me it was temporary.
No, she's got
she
it.
Got it.
She's got it permanent now. And they, like they told her, well, they're thanks for bringing humanity in this place, the warmth of humanity. That's one thing I hope anybody in the village would. But she said what she taught, and she said up there to them, she told them earlier, I own this place. And they're saying, well, after all, I own this place. See, I was there. Well, she does.
Well, tell her why. Did she explain why she said it?
And she said, I learned it from you. She said, up at the village. Until you own this place, you're not going to be doing your job right. But when you own it, then you will. And it was theirs. And I try to stress this to the group that I was with now this winter, that each of you goes out with a different Holden village, but it's yours. You have a right to a different village. Each one brings his own way. You can't impose one village on everyone. It's beautiful that it is that way.
I heard some of the anger. We weren't up there that particular time when they were doing the film, but the anger when someone tried to make it into a particular format, that people just didn't like that.
Can't. The one film we did do that Paul Fanning didn't like, I thought was useful in taking the men off, because the women were responding more than men. Men thought they were going to be coerced to go into classes, that they've got to be part of something religious, they ruin their whole vacation, you know, and some wives are using it that way with them. In fact, we had two wives, specifically one, which a divorce occurred later because her husband's converted up there. Another wife who said she's in control of Satan because she's so unhappy about the conversion of her husband there, she no longer had one up on him. And
she
these weren't dumb
holier
people.
Than he was.
Yeah,
was.
No longer her soul. See. It was hard for her to take. That's where I used her baptism to relieve her from that feeling of demonic possession. Because she really was. Her son's up at the village next week, you know. But this other one was really quite a big shot in the oil business in America. And his wife divorced him. We always used his place for the retreat during the winter for the lifestyle people. But she was also in the tongue-speaking movement. And her husband was converted. She got rid of him. Well, there was enough of that, I knew, in American life. We have lists. admittedly, we Lutherans, until this moment, have had less of it. We're going to have a lot more of it now. But we haven't. We've been at church in which the males have never felt defensive for their... I've been in all three synods for the village, over almost every area of America. Not so much in the South, because we aren't that much in the South. But every place except my local parish at Minneapolis, where we have 3,900 single women and widows. I am aware of men, and not just women. The men are, by statistics, 94 to 100. The Christian Science, it's 16 to 100. Well, we're going to make it. This mother, God, and only daughters, you're going to have Christian Science and 16 men. And those men aren't going to be worth being around with. I mean, you're going to wonder when they're going to get some pants to put on. They're going to get some pants to put on. And Rosemary Ruth was keen enough to see this way back when. She used some pretty strong words about it. Because this, she couldn't buy for the result of this. It's sad. That's what's going to be. Then we only have a hostility of work and not the biblical reapproachment here, which really needs to happen and must happen, where women have their full dignity and right, equal pay, equal tasks, equal chance. But that's why we celebrate Lane so much, because she made it in a man's world.
I told her it was better than a PhD,
yeah,
as far as I was concerned.
Oh, that was great.
But she has blossomed so, which is a word that you use, but it is just
she
looks great.
Come and sit down.
Well, you heard, the biggest hurt I have in the village is the lives we deflected for a while. Doug Spanny is on in again, for instance. He's going to church, and things are moving. And I've been just heartbroken over him. I have not communicated with him. He hasn't communicated with me since he's left the village, but I've kept
track
of him.
Oh, yes, you saw him at one place.
Yeah, but he hasn't
written. Yeah, you know where it is.
Keep talking.
Right ahead.
But it's that, and now as I see people find new ways to express the creativity God's put into them, where they are out there in the world and out up at the village, I rejoice.
Yeah,
It's a relief. And until the last one that was involved with the village in my time has that, I'll still have a little grief at deflecting some lives through it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to.
Yeah, right. I don't think, though, I think what you have to remember is that they weren't any more deflected than they would have been anyway. Mm.
Oh, I know, and some you can't do. Like you mentioned, this one person who tithed everything, and he got in with his screwball outfit underneath
the
Lutheran pastor, and they all gave up their possessions to him,
yes,
and so on. But
yes.
I know, what can you do about it? And hundreds of hours with him, or our other brother from down under the armpit of America, who
I know,
also didn't work out.
Still, you don't.
Hundreds of hours with him. Well, some of those you have, that just didn't work, even the whole community. But what was, I think, the first experience, the very first summer, that was so wonderful, is that in a community where there's total acceptance, where there's no guilt, where the gospel really is heard and acted on so that it gets through to them, there is a tremendous healing power over against the schizophrenic, for instance.
Yeah.
And we had those beautiful experiences of the schizophrenics right through the whole experience.
Right. I'll let you sit over here, Carol.
And once we realized they had to stay for 6 months, it helped a little bit.
That much to eat.
Should we turn off whatever she's got going here now? Because
I think we should.
Can.